I'm going to call the meeting to order, a regular meeting of 11-2, November 2nd. Savannah County Board of Supervisors to order. First, we will stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Sorry, it's already down there.
In that moment, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic which stands one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay.
Okay, now we'll adopt the agenda for the meeting. Are there any recommended changes or updates?
Nope.
All right, any objections?
No.
Motion to adopt it? Did we do that? All right, motion's been made to adopt the agenda, seconded by Mrs. Booker. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Chair votes aye. Board, motion passes 4-0-1. Mr. Sheridan being absent. Now I'll have the county administrator's report. Mr. Dahl.
Yep, members of the board, just got a few things to report to you this evening. So a happy early birthday to Ms. Booker. Next Tuesday on Election Day.
Only Election Day, again.
Well, happy early birthday.
Yeah, thank you.
We got a few new employees that started. We got Matthew Mitchell that started for the Public Utilities Department as the Water Utility System Manager. He started October 24th, and great to have him. He came from a previous water authority, and then great thing, he lives right here in the county, so happy to have him. Also, Lauren Johnson started with the Department of Social Services on October 25th, and she's a Human Services Assistant 3. Glad to have both of them on board with the county.
Is Water Utility System Manager, is that what Roger used to do?
No, sir.
No.
Okay.
That's what those bills and stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So this past weekend, on October 29th, from 6:30 to 8:30, we had the Trunk or Treat at Pleasant Grove Park, the Halloween 2022 annual Halloween festival. Activities included the Trunk or Treat area and the semi-scary trail. It was very heavily populated and attended that day. There was about a 30 to 40 minute wait to get through. Mr. Spitzer, from getting some numbers, he counted that there's probably about 1,300 people that attended in about a 2 hour period, which is just absolutely fantastic.
Right.
About a little over 1,100 children and adults went down the semi-scary trail. And then again, some just kind of did the trunk or treat. There were 22 registered vehicles to hand out candy. Trunks included county departments, residences, businesses, community groups, and a big thanks to the Boy Scout Troop 138, Girl Scout Troop 1154, High School SGA and FUMA Interact Club for the help with the semi-scary trail. And definitely helped to the Boy Scout Troop 154 for help with parking. Like I said, it was a well-attended event. Every time after these big events, Mr. Spitzer saying, I don't have enough people to do what we're doing,
yeah.
Especially with all the parking. And it's a little bit of a hairy situation with the one way in, one way out sometimes with so many people coming and going.
Right.
But like I said, his Parks and Rec and everyone included and involved did a fantastic job.
And that was a kind of chilly night too.
It was.
And a lot of the young people that participated, you know.
Yeah.
Aaron, I was telling him, my 4-year-old granddaughter went through the little scary thing. She told the guy, said, I'm not coming back here anymore.
Yeah, one kid made it to the beginning and turned around and said, I'm not going.
Yeah.
Was it too scary?
Yeah, I think she made it through. She was quiet the whole time, but she got through. She said, I'm not coming back anymore.
So she tried to jump out and scare you.
So here are just a few pictures from the event. So you can see this is the big field where everyone parks through the county fair. Cars are almost parked up to 53 there. And again, this is kind of like the circle where all the cars were parked with trunk or treat and the line, like I said, very well attended. So kudos to Parks and Rec and everyone involved. So the library was awarded a grant of $6,000 from the Library of Virginia with ARPA funds for a privacy pod for their facility. So basically, you can see the picture below there. Privacy pod is a soundproof pod that can provide people some privacy if they need to do online telehealth appointments, if there's meetings, trainings, job interviews, or anything like that. It has ventilation and utilizes the library's Wi-Fi. And they qualified for the grant because Flavanna was deemed to have a limited access to healthcare facilities in the county. So there's just a few pictures of the pod itself right there. And just some upcoming meetings for the board. Again, next Thursday, November 10th at 8:30 a.m., we have the elected officials breakfast at the library. Just remember that. And like I said, if you have any additional, we're still working on some.
Haven't gotten any.
If the board has anything that they want to submit as far as issues that we want to bring up with the legislators, happy to have those submitted to us, myself. November 16th, we have a 7 p.m. regular meeting. December 7th, a 5 p.m. regular meeting. And then December 21st, a 7 p.m. regular meeting.
Okay. Will there be a Zoom to the elected officials breakfast?
The Zoom will be available. It's not on the agenda. Well, you haven't seen the agenda yet, but it's not on the agenda. Any legislators who are coming will be in person. We don't think any will be attending, but public can attend, or if there are any other board members who can attend by Zoom.
Yeah, I will likely not be there.
Okay.
So if I can attend by Zoom, I
will.
Okay. Okay.
So.
Okay.
All right. Is that it?
Yep, that's it.
Okay, great. Any questions for the county administrator?
No, I was just asking Caitlin about the VACO conference that's coming up, and trying to get some more information on what kind of breakout sessions they're going to have. I guess they don't get them. She sent me my sheet, but you didn't find any breakout sessions, did you?
No, ma'am.
Yeah.
How about this? While we're looking, I bet you Kelly will find something, and we'll see if we can get something to you before.
I'm going down on the 12th to take that tour. They have a tour going to affordable housing in Chesterfield, I believe, but the VACO conference don't start the next day, the 13th.
Yeah, correct.
So I'll just have to drive down to the Marriott Park down there. Take the tour, I think it's at 1:30.
Okay.
So I'm glad this came up, because I didn't mean to ask. I had it in my schedule, but I don't remember us ever saying who's going and who's not. Right. And maybe we didn't, I just forget it. But
so all the board members besides Mrs. Eager are going.
Okay.
And then myself.
Yeah, and it's nice to have where the breakouts are to be, so we can, try to have somebody be in most of them, so we all don't hang up and run in.
Yeah.
But we'll do that once we get down there.
Yeah, and then like I said, when you check into the VACO event too, usually that day you get they give you all the literature and brochures for the different, the different vendors areas, the different breakout sessions, kind of a hard copy schedule. And there's also something, there's a schedule via the phone, a phone app that they usually have too. But we'll see if we can get something to.
Coming to them right now.
Coming to you right now, should be coming to you in your email. There should be an agenda schedule.
All right, thank you.
Yep.
Okay. We will now open our first round of public comments. Anyone wishing to address the board should come to the podium and state your name and address. Please remember to keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and directed to the board. Anybody wishing to address the board at this time?
I'll go first. Corbin Flynn, 319 Shiloh Church Road, Mr. Chairman, Board. Specifically, thoughts to leave with you folks, along with Pearson appraisal, with the upcoming reassessment. So my question and or thought really more points towards commercial property. Over the last 5 months, I've been coming to some of these meetings as a result of commercial property, specifically. And the commercial property land has increased, and we'll focus on Lake Monticello. Around Lake Monticello, the three roads focusing around Lake Monticello, just in the last 4 months, the county has increased the amount of property by over 50%. So there's much more supply. I'm not so sure that there's that much demand in commercial real estate. The commercial, I think it's the Charlottesville Commercial MLS service has only shown 3 sales of commercial property in Fremantle County since January 1, 2021. And that's not all the sales or transactions that have taken place in commercial, because others take place outside of the MLS. But you could count them all on 2 hands and still have fingers left over. So it's difficult to be able to come up with a value of commercial property. However, again, if you have more property and demand does not keep up with that, then the values should come down. The other part, which I'm not sure how far back Pearson Appraisal has assessed property values, but the discrepancy is significant. Not necessarily their fault or the board's fault or the Commissioner of Revenue's fault. However, just in commercial property alone around Lake Monticello, you have commercial property zoned under 16,000 an acre and some zoned over 200,000 an acre. Doesn't seem very fair to me. You have property zoned $150,000 an acre and right next door to it zoned $50,000 an acre. And I'm just talking about the land. I'm not talking about the buildings on the land. The discrepancy in the building per square foot is significant as well. In real estate, it's all location, location, location. Property at Zions Crossroad commercial is a higher value than property in Fork Union commercial. Same thing rings with residential property. However, you go to Lake Monticello, almost every single developed lot in Lake Monticello that's not on the golf course or not on the water, the land value is tax assessed at around $25,000 to $28,000 an acre. You can have a 1,300 square foot house, the land value is the same as the guy next door that's got a 3,000 square foot house. So that value doesn't change based on whatever somebody builds on it. And it shouldn't change for commercial property either, specifically when we're talking about right around Lake Monticello. All of the property at Lake Monticello should be relatively equal in value when it's within less than a mile apart from each other. And so I'm curious to see what my new assessment will be coming out, the fact that there is much more supply and the demand is not significant to keep up with that supply, especially if you go back over the last 2 years, what the county has approved A1 property not only to B1 but also to R3, which allows more commercial development. So it's relatively, I don't want to say that Mr. Willis's job is easy to appraise a house in Lake Monticello that's 1,300 square foot, but it's much more easier to appraise that than it is to appraise commercial property. And you can't do it on sales because they just don't exist. However, the county itself, the Commissioner of Revenue, the board needs to look at this and make sure that everybody in the county is being treated fairly. I don't think it's right for me to pay $200,000 an acre for my commercial property and somebody else pay $16,000 an acre for theirs. Now, I don't want them to have to pay more. I'd actually like to pay less. But it's definitely a discrepancy. And I think it's important that this board be aware of that. And Mr. Willis may have some information about that. I don't expect him to have it so much. And I'm going to have to watch him on Zoom. So thank you guys for your time.
Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else wishing to speak at this time? Is there anyone online, Mr. Dahl?
I don't see anyone raising their hand at this point online. Let me just... Yeah, I don't see anyone raising their hand.
If there's anyone online that would like to speak, please raise your hand. Seeing none, I will now close the first round of public comment. Next up is public hearings. We have none, so we'll move forward with action matters. First up is A, approval of the Thomas TJPDC Regional Legislative Program. Mr. Blunt.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. You have before you the Regional Legislative Program for 2023 for approval. And the memo that's included in your packet notes that there are three top priorities for the upcoming session this year. They are public education, budgets and funding, and broadband. First up, if I could just explain a little bit about each of those priorities. Public education funding, back in the top three this year. I would say state funding for K-12 education continues to be one of the top, if not the top, issue that I hear from localities in the region. Really resonates year to year. It's been an ongoing position for the region's localities to support state funding for public education. I did want to, point you to a couple of specific changes in the language that come as a result of some of the discussion that we had when I was here back in September, as well as with some of the other localities. Language that supports flexibility for increasing salaries when there is a state supplement, because as you know, that supplement usually just covers those SOQ supported positions and not all of your school employees. Also, as I believe Mr. Chairman had brought up about the need for a pipeline program for teachers, especially in critical shortage areas, we've added some language in the draft program on that, and then continued some language that you all had suggested from either last year or the year before, just making sure that we're asking the state for some funding and support as it relates to helping to employ school bus drivers, which is still a very important need. Under the priority on budgets and funding, this is really the state aid support, the unfunded mandates position, the local revenue authority position, again, one that we've had for a number of years. The draft does contain some additional language. Near the end, we talk about the state not eliminating or restricting local revenue sources. You'll recall during this past General Assembly session, there was a lot of discussion about the grocery tax, which has a local option sales tax portion and a state sales tax portion. Ultimately, the action was taken to just pull back on the state sales tax portion, leave the local option sales tax as it's applied to groceries in place. We want to make sure that that continues to happen. The final priority position is broadband. No changes this year to that position. As you know, we're very active across the region, working with Firefly to bring broadband to counties in the region. Just very briefly, I wanted to point out a couple of the changes in the legislative positions section of the program. The page there lists some of the most significant changes. Again, just to kind of reflect on some of the issues that we had talked about previously, or that you all have mentioned previously, under the housing position statement on page 6, we've added some language to put some additional emphasis on incentives and local authority as it relates to promoting housing that is affordable. And then a couple of new bullets under the public safety section, which I think is there at the end. I wanted to point out the first two there, because we talked at our last meeting in September about support for paid and volunteer first responders. So we've added some support statements in there with that. And then urging state assistance in the recruitment and retention of law enforcement personnel. But as you can see, a number of other statements that have been updated as well. So that is what I wanted to present to you. Certainly glad to take any questions that you may have and recommend to you that you vote to approve the program this evening.
Any questions or comments, folks?
I read the report. It's extensive and good. Thank you, as always.
Zager?
No, I don't have any questions.
No questions.
Ms. Fairchild?
Good.
All right. Do we have a motion?
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the 2023 Thomas Jefferson Planning District Legislative Program as presented.
Second.
Motion is made by Ms. Booker and seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Look forward to seeing you.
See you this week or next week.
Meeting next week. Thank you.
Next up is B, authorization to advertise Chapter 8 Fire Protection and Public Safety Ordinance. Mr. Dahl.
Yep. So we're going to be going over Chapter 8 Fire Protection, Emergency Services, and Public Safety for the County Code. So the current Chapter 8 of the Fire Protection and Public Safety Ordinance is what it is called now, is being significantly revised for the county in the near future to establish a Fluvanna County Department of Emergency Services, which allows the county to hire and provide EMS services, again, provide paid county staff EMS services, and this would assist and augment the existing volunteer agencies currently doing that. So the reenacted Chapter 8, which would be called Fire Protection, Emergency Services, and Public Safety Ordinance, the primary edition set forth the establishment of a county department, defines the powers and duties of volunteer agencies, defines members of the official safety program, establishment and composition of the system, responsibilities and roles within the system, creates a Fluvanna County System Advisory Board, and defines responsibilities and then outlines the system policy requirements. I'm going to go into each kind of section on this to kind of show you if it's a new section or if it's an existing section. So section 8.1, definitions. There's an existing definition section in our county ordinance. It's actually currently section 8-6-2, but the new county ordinance certainly expands upon those definitions because there's certainly more to this new ordinance and reenacted ordinance. Section 8.2, which is the establishment of the Fluvanna County Department of Emergency Services. This is a new section to the ordinance. And again, this basically establishes a county department of emergency services. Section 8.3, which is called volunteer agencies. This one is titled different, but it's an existing section. Currently, it's section 8.1, but it's called fire companies. So again, really what this does, it expands upon that existing ordinance to include the importance of the volunteer agencies, the powers, duties, and responsibilities. Section 8.4 of the new ordinance is official safety program. This is basically an existing section. In our current ordinance, it's currently section 8.3. Section 8.5 is called the establishment and composition of system. Again, this is a new section to the ordinance. This basically establishes the Fluvanna County Coordinated Fire and Rescue System made up of EMS department and volunteer agencies. And again, a lot of these things are in place, but this just more or less codifies it in our code and provides some authority and some powers and responsibilities within our code. Section 8.6 is called responsibilities of the system. This is new, and again, it sets forth responsibilities of the system. Section 8.7, emergency medical services agency chief. This is new. It basically establishes oversight of the EMS department, which would initially be the county administrator. And if the board so chooses at a later point to hire, whether a rescue chief or a fire and rescue chief, then that person would then serve as the emergency medical services agency chief. Section 8.8, Fluvanna County System Advisory Board established. Again, this is a new section. This creates an advisory board to the EMS department made up of county staff and the FRA, which is the Fire and Rescue Association. Section 8.9, Fluvanna County System Advisory Board responsibilities. This is new. It just sets forth the responsibilities of the advisory board. And I think we got one more page of new, then we probably got about a couple pages of existing. Section 8.10, this is the Fluvanna County System Policies. This is new. This establishes a requirement for following applicable federal and state law, county code, and system policies if applicable. The department and volunteer agents have different policies that will meet the requirements, but at some point there could be a system-wide policies at a later point. But what this does is you've got volunteer agencies that follow policies that are applicable to federal, state code, county code, and then you'll have, for the county EMS department, you would have policies as well. Some of them may be very similar, but they're not identical. Section 8.11 is called compliance with system policies and remediation. Again, this is a new section and just establishes what are the compliance factors with those policies. Section 8.12 is called criminal and driving record checks. This is a new section that basically establishes a requirement for the department and volunteer agencies to check criminal and driving records. Again, some of this stuff is not new that volunteer agencies or anything or the county would be doing. This is something that's already done, but it just puts it into code and codifies it. And then a lot of these, for the next couple pages, these are all existing. But so again, section 8.13, it's called regulation governing the use of county fire trucks. Again, this is an existing section in our county code. It's currently section 8.2. Section 8.14, certification of firefighters age 16 years and older. Again, this is an existing section in our current county code, currently section 8.4. Section 8.15, called disposal of unclaimed personal property in the possession of the sheriff. Again, this is an existing section in the county code, currently it's section 8.5, sorry, 8-5. Section 8-16, emergency medical services cost recovery. This is an existing section in our current county code. Currently it's section 8.6. Section 8-16-1, purpose and fact finding. Again, this is an existing section. Currently in our current code, it's section 8-6-1. And I think this is the last page, I think. Section 8-16-1. Oh, I think I had duplication there. I apologize. Let me see here. I had a duplication. I apologize for that. Copying and pasting a lot of pages there. Section 8-16-2 in this current ordinance. Again, this is more for definitions as they relate to the EMS cost recovery, basically. And again, the definitions, this is the existing section, and currently it's section 8-6-2. New section 8-16-3 is permits required, and this is applicable to transporting and EMS cost recovery. This is an existing section. Currently, it's section 8-6-3. Section 8-16-4, it's a section called fees for emergency medical services, vehicle transports. Again, this is an existing section. Currently, it's 8-6-4. And I'm certain this is the last one. Section 8-17, which deals with employment of off-duty deputy sheriffs. This was a policy, I think, that was adopted, I want to say earlier on in this current year. Oh, 2021. It was in 2021. But again, this is an existing section of the current ordinance. Currently, it's section 8-7. So again, what this really does, this ordinance, and again, tonight, really what the board's doing is just allowing authorization to advertise to the ordinance. There's, before any of this would be considered for approval, we've got it scheduled to be at the December 7th board meeting for a public hearing at 7. And that's when the board would consider this for adoption if they so choose. So again, what this really does is allow the county to hire and create its own EMS department. Currently, we've got a contract provider that does that. But again, this would allow it to transition from a contract crew to being a county paid staff for EMS services. Kind of looking at the fiscal impact a little bit of this. Again, the fiscal impact, and we'll bring some more back to the board, and we've showed you some previous things, but the fiscal impact will be determined based upon the future EMS department structure selected and the number of employees associated with it. So depending on how many people and how many shifts you have at each different agency, that would be determined on what the cost structure is. And then currently at minimum, the county already has a little over $1 million that's built into the existing budget to cover startup costs for a Department of Emergency Services. Again, we've got funds that go to a contract. So if the county approves this, then we would move away from having a contract provider doing it, and then we would go towards it being a county-run department. As far as, you know, some additional approvals that would be needed by the board in addition to this ordinance, one is we'd have to create position descriptions. We'd have to determine what's the structure, what's the makeup of the department, what does it look like? Do we have, you know, how many 24-hour, 7-day-a-week trucks do we have at how many stations, how many shifts per station? And so we'll be bringing some things like that back to the board for this. Again, even though we implement this, doesn't mean that we've got people ready to go. It's gonna still take some time to get this implemented. But that's all I have right now as far as this. And again, the ultimate decision for this would be December 7th. We've discussed this at length with the Fire and Rescue Association, agents, all the chiefs, and at many meetings, I know some other board members were there. I haven't heard anyone against going this way, unless something's changed. But so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions the board has. Ms. Smith and Ms. Hoffman are here as well. Again, some of the ordinance pieces of this, you know, again, you know, one, they were kind of pulled from other existing similar ordinances from Albemarle County, looked a little bit at Goochland, and, you know, looked at policies, looked at Louisa. So again, we didn't pull this from out of thin air. There's some things that are already in place. The ordinance has been reviewed by the Fire and Rescue Association, and, you know, we've taken into consideration comments and things that we could or could not, or felt that things that were or were not able to be implemented with this. And again, there are some questions, but again, we tried to put in here everything that we felt was applicable to the comments. And if there were some comments, some things that were in the existing code, we didn't remove things out of the existing current county code. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that the board has.
You go to section 8-8, the board.
Yep.
And this is made up of.
Oops, hold on, let me go back to the 8-8. Yep, the Fluvanna County, the Fluvanna County System Advisory Board. Yep, yep.
And these are all chiefs, EMC. There are no citizens on this.
No, it's not. The System Advisory Board is established, and it's advisory. It's advisory to myself, to the Emergency Management Coordinator, and the EMS Department. And the System Advisory Board is made up of us, as well as the Fire Rescue Association and the chiefs.
Okay. All right.
And so again, no policies or anything could be established unless there was a unanimous vote on those policies.
Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else?
Headed in the right direction.
Ms. Egan?
I think you and I talked about this earlier. You have the EMS chief and the EMC. And you said that they would both be you.
Well, no, and the EMC is Emergency Management Coordinator. That's Ms. Smith. The EMS chief initially would be me. The in the ordinance, the EMS chief is the same thing. The EMS chief and the EMD, the Emergency Management Director, which is I am the Emergency Management Director appointed by the county, they are one and the same. Again, as I said before, if the board said at some point, you know, we want to hire, you know, a fire and rescue chief or a rescue chief or something like that, well, then that would be that would make the most sense to be then the EMS chief for the county then. But initially from just kind of a general oversight would fall to me for the department.
And if I recall, that was a term of confusion when we had that meeting, but it's required by...
The term EMS chief and Ms. Hoffman, if you want to come on... The term EMS...
It's required by statute to be in here that way.
To call it EMS, so it's confusing, but it is a...
It is what it is.
Can't believe lawyers make things confusing. The General Assembly did that.
Which is full of lawyers.
Mr. Fairchild?
I was in the meetings, thank you. I feel like I've...
I've caught up to speed. And this is just to advertise for it.
Correct.
So do we have a motion?
Hold on, let me get out of here. So there's a motion. Let me get rid of this.
You're going to move that or shrink it?
Yeah, let's do this. There we go, sorry.
Okay, I move the Board of Supervisors approve county staff and the county attorney to prepare and advertise the notice of a public hearing to be held on December 7th, 2022 at 7 p.m. contained in the board packet for the proposed ordinance to repeal Chapter 8, Fire Protection and Public Safety of the Fluvanna County Code in its entirety, and to adopt and reenact the proposed attached replacement ordinance entitled Chapter 8, Fire Protection, Emergency Services, and Public Safety of the Fluvanna County Code in its entirety.
And one thing, just Mrs. Eager brought up before too, it was either yesterday or today, in the actual ordinance there was two little Scribner's errors. There was one bullet that was blank and I don't remember what section it was in, and there was
89.
It was, and what was the other thing?
There's a numbering issue where it starts with two instead of one.
Yeah, so I mean those are just little Scribner errors. So before that goes out to, you know, being finalized, we'll correct those. But it's not nothing substantial to the ordinance itself, but we notice those. Mrs. Eager picked up on one of them after the fact, and then Ms. Hoffman picked up the other one, so thank you.
I second the motion.
Got a motion made by Mrs. Eager, and seconded by Mrs. Booker. Oh, my God. What am I doing? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
I can't use the call. Aye.
You really buggered that one up.
I totally did.
That's my turn.
Are those opposed? Signify by saying nay. Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Ms. Booker, I apologize. I don't know.
My world.
I will get sleep. All right. See.
We need to laugh.
I'm good for that every once in a while. All right. See. Resolution recommending appointment to the Board of Equalization, Mr. Dahl.
Yep. Go through this pretty quick again. So the Circuit Court has jurisdiction with each city and county. And again, in each tax year, merely following a general reassessment or annual or biennial assessment is conducted in such city, they need to appoint, the board must appoint a Board of Equalization for real estate assessments. So what happens is the board appoints members to serve on that board, then it goes before the Circuit Court for actual final appointment for the Board of Equalization. So one, every Board of Equalization shall be composed of not less than three members, nor more than five members, or the number of election districts in the locality, whichever is greater. Again, we have five election districts. And so previously, we've always had five BOE members. Last year, we had some alternates. This year, again, you know, getting some volunteers, we weren't able to get alternates this year, but we do have five BOE members. Let me think here. Yeah, bullet number three just talks about that we can include alternates. The last bullet really talks about appointments to the Board of Equalization. Again, it shall be broadly representative of the community. 30% of the members of the board shall be commercial or residential real estate appraisers. Other real estate professionals, builders, developers, or legal or financial professionals, and at least one such member shall sit in all cases involving commercial, industrial, or multifamily residential property unless waived by the taxpayer. Again, the members that have applied this year, I think we got one new one, right, Ms. Solis?
Mm-hmm.
One new individual that submitted. three of them that wanted to seek reappointment, they actually were on the Board of Equalization last year. A fourth member was an alternate that the board appointed to the Board of Equalization last year, but that individual has expressed interest in being a BOE member. So we need to fill five slots. We have five individuals to fill those five slots.
And reviewing their applications, it seems like they represent that last bullet point pretty much to the T.
Yeah. And again, these are the individuals. Again, Mr. Daniel Nunziato from the Cunningham District, former member of Economic Development Authority, and he's been a BOE member for 2019-21. Miss Gloria Vess, Columbia District, former Chief Deputy Treasurer of Fluvanna County. She was a former BOE member, 2019-21. Mr. Ron Lozier from the Cunningham District, former board member of the Thomas Jefferson Soil and Water Conservation District, former board member of the Thomas Jefferson Housing Improvement Corporation, founding director of the Fluvanna Luisa Housing Foundation, former board member of the Piedmont Housing Alliance, and a former BOE member in 2021. Mr. Scott Marshall, Cunningham District, was on the Fluvanna County Economic Development Authority 2002 to 2020, Fluvanna County Parks and Rec 2002 to 2014, and then he was a former alternate BOE member for 2021. And then the new submission, Mr. Nelson Cook, Columbia District, Director of Pre-Construction for a company in Richmond, former Chief Estimator in Seattle, Washington, current member of Parks and Rec Advisory Board, and new applicant to serve on the 2023 BOE. So those are the five individuals that have submitted. And again, we have to, remember correctly, have this submitted in plenty of time to get it going before the circuit court and before the end of the fiscal year, I mean calendar year, correct?
Yes, and that may take some running around because we've got new judges.
So those are the individuals that we have, and like I said, happy to answer any questions, or we can bring up any more information.
So are we making two motions?
We've got five and five positions.
Yep.
But are we doing, is the motion to adopt the resolution and to make the appointment of the five members at the same time?
The resolution should include with the appointments of the individuals, doesn't it?
It's not appointments.
Recommendations. Correct.
Recommendations.
Thank you.
Because circuit court reports.
Yep. So the motion for that is on the screen.
I move the Board of Supervisors adopt a resolution entitled A Resolution Recommending Appointment to the Board of Equalization.
Second.
Motion is made by Mr. O'Brien, second by Ms. Seeger. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. There are no appointments. We will now move forward with presentations, normally not to exceed 10 minutes each. D, Community Investment Collaborative, CIC update, Stephen Davis, President.
Good evening. Excuse me, can't talk this evening. Good evening, members of the board.
After the mistake I just made, anything.
So, good to follow, I guess, right? So thank you so much for having me back here. It's great to be here outside of budget season to provide an update on our work. So for those who I may not have met before, Stephen Davis, president of the Community Investment Collaborative, or CIC. We're what's called the next slide.
Hey, let me know.
We're what's called a community development finance institution. We were certified as such last year. It's a CDFI, is a Treasury Department certification that says you are a lender that serves underserved populations. And we've CIC is celebrating our 10-year anniversary actually this weekend with an event. But we've been serving the region during that time. So we're a microloan fund. We offer entrepreneur support services, including a 16-week entrepreneur workshop, mentoring, financial management program, networking, lots of other resources. We are also host of the Central Virginia SBDC, which you'll hear from as the next update, separating them out because they're kind of two very large programs that have overlapping services, but very kind of different focal points. CIC really does focus on under-resourced entrepreneurs, those who are often have been left out or behind or have had trouble accessing capital and working to help create opportunities for them. So, next slide. So our program is built on four pillars: education, mentoring, financing, networking. I've mentioned the workshop, the microloan program. I always like to give Fluvanna County credit. You know, the first county that helped set up a loan fund with CIC when it was launched 10 years ago. And I'll give you an update on that loan fund in just a minute or two. But I appreciate your support since we launched with that. Next, kind of lifetime results. Every dollar CIC spent over the last 10 years has returned $6.28 to the community just from new wages. Wages from new jobs. And that does not count other economic impacts of those businesses, that the amount of activity they're doing businesses with business with other businesses and so forth. That's the thing we can track. The rest of it, it's a lot more challenging, but we do keep an eye on that. And that represents 131 new businesses, of which 105 are still open, and nearly 300 new full-time equivalent jobs in that time period. And these are all micro businesses, I should mention. These are all businesses that might be one, two, three people. A few have gotten up to 10 or 12. So, next slide, Eric. This slide here has a little bit of the history of our service to Fluvanna County residents. And I should state that this is residents, because some folks who may live in Louisa start a business in Fluvanna, some in Fluvanna start a business in Louisa or other places, just kind of depending on where their kind of center of gravity is. But this outlines kind of the number of clients we serve. As you can see, in 2020 and 2021, we had a significant uptick, and that's related largely to COVID and additional outreach and work that we did with the Economic Development Authority and other partners in Fluvanna County. So the different colors represent different parts of our program. The darker green in 2020 and 2021 is the financing part of the program. So that's loans, and in a couple of cases, small grant programs. This does not include all the CARES Act grants that we partnered with you on. This is just kind of traditional, like ongoing work. But the dark green would include, specific loans made in the last couple of years, including helping folks get through COVID, but they were loans, not the larger CARES Act grants that we've talked about before that we helped partner with you on. So this just gives you a sense of that volume and the kind of uptick. A little bit down this year from last year, largely because we did fewer of those COVID-related loans, but we're still continuing to see folks. All of the loans that we did last year, we're continuing to work with those clients as well, but this just represents those new folks that we've seen. Next slide, Eric. So here's an update on our loan fund. Your original loan fund that you provided us was $45,000. We have made just under $65,000 in loans from it over the years. These loans, I think the largest we've made from your fund is about $20,000, but most of them have been in the 10 or 12 range, with a few, and some under that as well. It gives you a sense of principal paid. We had one early loss from the early years, that's represented in that 4,200, and then the outstanding loan balance. So when I reported to you last summer, we were basically, all the funds were out, and now we have a few more back in that are specifically available from this fund. If a Fluvanna County business came in right now and needed $25,000, or we've raised our cap now to $50,000, we could do it. We could do $10,000 from your fund and then source from other funds that we've been able to secure through the Department of Treasury, Virginia Department of Housing and Community Development, Department of Agriculture, and other sources of funds. So a Fluvanna County business would not miss out on any opportunity because of the low balance in the fund at the moment. It's just the specific fund that you made available. This is what we have. So that's kind of where the balance is. We have one borrower, who is behind on payments at the moment of our current loans. Obviously, won't name names or others of that in this setting, but the loan fund does continue to operate, and we're always, we get, I'd say, for every completed application, there's usually about three or four inquiries of folks who kind of start talking about, thinking about it. We help a few folks figure out they don't need money, they need to work on this marketing or this other part of their business, and that happens either through us or through connection with the SBDC. And then others, as they move forward, we help them secure that financing. The next slide, please. a partial list of clients, you know, some of which you recognize, and then there are more, you know, that from the list, but just giving you a few that we have worked with, both going back a number of years and more recently. And then I want to give it, we just completed our strategic plan for NCO. So the next couple slides have a lot of text. Not going to talk through all of them. We have three big goals in our next strategic plan. And the next, so CIC last December hit the $2 million mark in our total lending over, at that point, about 9.5 years. So it took us 9.5 years to do about $2 million. Our goal is to do $3 million over the next 3 years. We've really seen a growth in the last year or two, and we're looking to kind of help more businesses access capital, especially those who have trouble accessing from traditional bank sources because of credit score, time in business, collateral, all those types of things that can make it hard to access capital. So that's one of our biggest goals, is to increase our lending in that time period. Number two, we want to help entrepreneurs in the region access 30 to 40 million. And this is where SBDC being a part of CIC is really tied into this goal. Not only do we do loans, but the SBDC can help them work with other financiers, other banks to access larger loans and help the business really be prepared to do so. I'm sure Rebecca will tap on that in a few minutes. And then the third goal, across CIC, SBDC together, we want to support 1,500 entrepreneurs through the one-on-one support in the next 3 years. We will probably do half of that in year one, and then a good number of those continue into year two or three because we work with them over a longer period of time. So just because, you know, they, you know, work with them a little bit now and they come back in 6 months because they work on something else because they have the good experience, and that's intentional. So those are the three big picture goals that we have and that we're tracking. The next slide, next two slides have, I'll start on this one, have just a couple of our strategies. I'm not going to read all of these to you. I want to point out a couple things I highlighted. You know, the first one, we want to deploy larger and more impactful financial products to our clients. So we've raised our cap from 35 to 50, and we're thinking about, there's still a gap where a lot of banks don't do a lot of small business lending under, you know, 100,000 or potentially even higher, especially for new businesses, especially for business under 2 years old, and folks who, you know, have, who are improving credit but not long-term solid credit, all of those reasons. So we want to help more folks access the capital they need. In addition to that, exploring beyond microloans, what would other types of investments look like that could really help close the gap and help people, more folks access the capital they need. Skipping ahead a couple of the points here, we want to maintain our SBDC capacity. We've grown it significantly the last couple of years. Rebecca will tell you all about it, but we want to make sure that 4,500 hours of counseling is 4.5 times larger than it was 3 years ago, and we want to make sure that's maintained. And the last slide here, we're also, as a part of doing all these loans, we've been very, we're based in Charlottesville and we're Charlottesville-centric and kind of where the volume of those are. You know, that 2 million in loans, I think we're probably 1.6 or 1.7, you know, we're, you know, Charlottesville or Albemarle County. And so we're looking to significantly increase the amount of loans in other communities in Central Virginia, including Fluvanna, Louisa, we serve all the way up to Culpeper. And so we want 35% of our lending over the next 3 years to be outside of Charlottesville and Albemarle. And so that'll require, you know, more work, more relationships, and building that to help businesses throughout the region grow. And finally, I'll mention how we, part of how we get to that, and that is we're looking to, the third bullet in there grows our balance sheet to about $4.5 million in assets over the next 3 years. We're about 2.5 at the moment. So we're raising more capital. We're going to be borrowing from federal government, from some potentially banks and others to deploy more capital and leveraging that against resources that we already have in place. So a lot of work to do that to help bring more capital to the region. And then to sustain the organization long term, we want to make sure that we are not only reliant on government support. You know, CIC's, our programs has been historically about 60 to 70% non-government support. And the SBDC piece has been like 5 or 10%. We're looking to increase both of those by raising more private support and other sources of funding. Doesn't mean we won't ever ask, but it does mean we're looking to make it more sustainable in the long term. Doing more loans leads to more earned revenue for us. We keep interest rates low, but we do have earned revenue that helps us support the organization. So there's a few others in there. I didn't hit on all the bullets in that, just for the sake of time, but happy to take your questions about our program and where we're going.
Remember one time, did you all do your program for Fluvanna and Louisa in this area?
Yep, in 2015.
Did you see that you got more clients from the rural area when you moved it closer to us?
So for background for everyone, in 2015, we ran the workshop at Zion's Crossroad at the Best Western right there, and serving Fluvanna and Louisa together right on the border, technically just on the other side of the border, I believe. And we had about 15 entrepreneurs in one cohort and about 10 in the other. Of that 25, there were 4 or 5 who actually came from Charlottesville or Eastern Albemarle, and a couple who came from Richmond. And so we really needed enough to get to a number of at least about 15 to sustain doing it ongoing. And so we didn't continue in future years running here, but we did see an uptick in clients from both communities as a result. And I think if Fluvanna is third behind Charlottesville and Albemarle as far as the like highest number of clients we see from year to year. So we have seen that uptick. If we thought there was a significant demand to be able to do it in some ongoing way, we'd be interested in pursuing it. It's just a matter of that demand and kind of the funding to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
I applaud you for giving data mm-hmm. and facts of mm-hmm. how it's affecting our community. Mm-hmm. When you say underserved communities, mm-hmm. how do you all define that?
So we have 4 target populations for CIC. So first, it would be individuals from low to moderate income households, as defined by the area's median income. You know, and so we know that just on, and keep in mind what I'm talking about now is just the CIC side of the house. You know, so just over about 74% of our clients are under the area's median income when they enter our program. Ideally,
I'm sorry, you said how many? Percent?
Just so 74% of our clients are under the area's median income when they enter our program. We obviously want them to grow beyond that, and we continue supporting them if they grow. So that's the first target population. The second is Black, Indigenous, and persons of color, you know, and so more, you know, sometimes defined minority populations, and just over 50% of our clients would identify as, you know, one of those groups in a region where that number is about 24-25%. Third population is women. I'll tell the story of my aunt who, before she was married, couldn't get a credit card. When she got married, she could because she had a husband to co-sign. And so that was, you know, 30 years ago, but there's still a lot of remnants of women who have trouble accessing credit. The policies have changed, but sometimes the history hasn't caught up, you know, and so women are a target population. And then the final is folks who return to the community after serving time in prison often have challenges finding employment. If they can create their own employment through their own business, it's a great opportunity for them. We don't ask that question, but we often learn it through working with them or get referrals from OAR. We get letters once, probably 2 or 3 letters a year from people in jail who've heard about us through different outreach and programs to say, I'm getting out and I've heard about it, how do I apply? Our best estimate, I think it was 3 years ago last time we updated, was about 10 to 12% of our clients have served time at some point in their life. So those would be the target populations.
Okay. And so the number of, I think you said for every dollar mm-hmm. invested, it was 6.2...
2.8, yep.
Yeah. And wages. So, and I was trying to think of a different word than assumption, mm-hmm. just for the sake of...
I made a bunch of assumptions to get that.
Is that an assumption that those businesses wouldn't exist without that investment? Because if it's creating $6.28 in payroll, mm-hmm. Is the assumption that $6, that some of those, that every bit of those wages would not be there if these investments had not happened?
I wouldn't go so far as to say none of them would have happened without us. I would say most of the clients say they made better decisions about how to start their business, sequencing, planning, and were in some cases more willing to take a risk to do it because of the confidence they built about how the business needed to work and how it could work. And then also were able to access financing because we helped them develop better business plans that either we helped finance or they sought it otherwise. So I can't go so far as to say none of that would have happened without us, because I believe our entrepreneurs are hardworking, smart people who can do it. But I'd say much of it, you know, or more of it happened, and more of it happened faster because we're doing it. Quantifying that would be much more challenging.
I hear you, but that took the total mm-hmm. that they're creating in
yep.
wages, correct?
New jobs. Yep. Yeah.
So like, some of that would not be associated potentially with this, as you said, the entrepreneurial spirit. Some of these businesses would not
yeah,
exist
for sure. And I'm also conservative in counting this as well. That like, you know, I don't know the wage of every job. We ask them to report it in kind of buckets, and then we kind of, you know, we actually assume a pretty low wage of 12 or 13 an hour to get to this calculation based on our alumni survey and stuff that we've done.
Thank you.
Two questions to kind of follow mm-hmm. along with Mr. Fairchild. One is, you listed the loans that weren't repaid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you listed the number of businesses that were started that are still in operation, or the failure rate of the businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a number for that, roughly?
The new businesses on that slide that had the 6.28, Eric, one of those, subtle point, 131
I'm
new.
I'm sorry, I did miss that.
Yeah, 131 new businesses have launched, and 105 of them, when we last did this survey in the spring, were still operating. You know, so 131 launched, and, you know, my quick math, 26, you know, did not sustain. Some of that, I don't have a measurement of whether that was a year or 3 years or whatever it was, but that's of the people who were not operating when they came to us. Another set of the 500 graduates of our workshop were existing businesses when they came in, and that was, some are super part-time, you know, side hustle. Some were, they sell at the farmer's market on Saturdays, but they haven't figured out how to get the food product into a grocery store yet, and they are trying to grow it more. And some were already close to full-time in it. Of the existing businesses, we've had a relatively even lower rate than that of folks who have decided not to pursue it ongoing, or like gotten out of business after they were operating. We've had a number of folks that we've helped. They came in doing a business on the side, and we taught them about, like, okay, here's how it could work, and they said, I don't think that's going to work for me with where I am, or it doesn't make sense to give up my day job to make this full time, so I'll keep it a supplemental income and keep my day job. So,
yeah. Bureau of Labor Statistics says that 20% of businesses will fail in the first 2 years,
mm-hmm.
40% will fail within the first 5 years, and 65% within the first 10 years.
Yep.
So the primary reasons are lack of planning, lack of funding, lack of investigating the market, it's kind of the traditional things, which I imagine is what you're addressing. So,
for sure,
you know, if you've only had 20% failure right there, you're in 10 years, you're doing much better than the 65% average from the BLS. So
yeah, and I think that's both from just survival in general, but also what we know. I was just at a conference called Opportunity Finance Network, which is other CDFIs like CIC, and the biggest, the most important. Kind of risk management tool that we all use. We all look at credit or different forms of credit. We all look at business history. We all look at all collateral, all the things that are traditional, and try to not be as traditional to help people access it. But the best risk management we all have is really building relationships and support, mm-hmm. so that, and not just relationships, they know us, but when they have a challenge, they call us to get help. Is the biggest indicator of whether they'll repay the loan, regardless of whether the business succeeds, because they know that you can trust and get your help to think through it.
Yeah, and I imagine take those same statistics and drill those down to the markets that you serve, and those statistics would be even higher in terms of failure rate. So, you know, to kind of address your question, mm-hmm. would they have existed, or mm-hmm. Mr. Fairchild's yeah. question, would they have mm-hmm. thrive regardless, I think part yeah. of the answer is clearly that they would not have. So that's commendable to what you and the SBDC do.
Thank you.
From that standpoint. Second question I had was, in terms of the loan growth rate, I know that, and maybe you guys were just a pass-through entity for some of the monies that were funded by Charlottesville Albemarle for the COVID loans. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the growth in your millions of dollars in growth there?
If I brought that chart from a different show, like, so we went from, you know, 2019 about $280,000 in loans to in that year to 2020 with COVID and those recovery loans about 870 to 2021 last year about 415, I believe was the number, and then this year right now with a couple of months left we're at 495. And, you know, we think we'll probably get to 650 or a little bit higher by the end of the year. So the COVID is just kind of completely, if you were to take the trajectory without that out, there's still the same growth, but there's a big line in the middle because of all those loans. So we were already, even before, you know, everything shut down in March, we had already that year done about 190 in March.
Gotcha.
And so we were already on it, but then everything changed, and the types of loans we did change for 6 months, and then we, as things stabilized and people came back, we got back on the trajectory we were.
So it was a boost, but not a major shift then?
It was not a major shift. The shift that led for that, one of the big lessons we learned from all of those loans is for our very small loans, like a lot of those were, like under 15, We can look at a smaller number of things to decide whether to do the loan or not, to make the application easier, faster, and help people get the capital in a much easier way. And the loans, with the support we have, are just as likely to be repaid as if we did a longer underwriting process. And that's an important lesson. So going forward, we can do smaller loans quicker and easier and spend more time on thinking about the bigger ones.
I just want to clarify. My question wasn't about whether it's a large percentage of them. It was whether all of them, which is what the 628 mm-hmm. Per hour.
Well, I thought it was a great question. Yeah, no, I was just sort of highlighting.
Yeah, I didn't mean it to challenge
that. No. And I wasn't thinking of that as a challenge. I was just sort of looking at, you know, how those statistics compare to what you see out. And for the services that something like CIC and SBDC do.
With what they're doing with the small businesses and things of that nature. I'm sure part of that 26 is probably COVID-related. You know, how many of them did we have to go out of business because of COVID, especially if it has any of the food industry or something of that nature.
It's really interesting. It's just my own antidote here. I have no hard data to back it up. More of the businesses that we serve that are generally undercapitalized, even with our support, right? They have less working capital, less kind of business reserves, all those things. I saw fewer of those businesses go out of business because the owner of it relied on the business. They, like, without the business, they didn't have something else. Whereas a business where someone had more reserves, maybe the person who started it came in with a little more kind of, you know, wealth or just kind of, you know, kind of money in their own bank account, they made the business decision that this was no longer worth it because they could afford and had somewhere else that they could do it.
Start over.
You know, and so it's a really important, if I could prove it, I would be great, but the antidote I feel is strong because I've seen a number of cases with, like, the owner of the restaurant, which one went out of business and which one didn't. And I think a good indicator is look at the owner's financial situation beforehand. And so I don't know that I can ever prove it, but I think it is an important thing that we're helping folks that the business is their livelihood. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
And Steve, you've been there how long?
So, yeah, CIC or Technic at this point is 10 and a half years old, and I've been there 9 and a half of those.
A lot of consistency because you've been
yep.
there.
Yep, I was employee number 2 and hired, and now we're up to 15.
Right. And it's quite a commitment when people join because you have a lot of time to just go to school and a lot of things. So, and I know a person who's been through it twice.
Yep, there's a couple of them.
So.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time and your support.
Thank you.
Next up is E, Central Virginia Small Business Development Center. Update, Ms. Rebecca Haydock.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Nice to see you all. Thank you all for what thoughtful questions, and thank you all for your support. I'll try to do this quickly so I can leave lots of time for questions. But the SBDC is, you know, I was here last year. It's grown quite a lot, and as Stephen has indicated, and as it turns out, it was a bit of a surprise to me. We've actually been the top performing SBDC in the state of Virginia for the last 2 years. That's based on the goals that were set for our region. We've far exceeded those goals. And as I think I've explained, you know, we work with concept stage businesses all the way through to some of the larger businesses in our region that can have over 20 million in sales. And that's because of the toolbox that we have. We have incredible research capabilities. We've been able to, through the COVID money and some other support, hire some very qualified technical contractors, as well as the core team is pretty well resourced and with strong management tools and strong backgrounds. So, and all of this, of course, as you know, thanks to your support, the SBA and other funders is available to entrepreneurs free of charge. The next slide. Thanks, Eric. I think you're all familiar with this. I won't read through all of this, but you all know we have a lot of research capability. We have international trade expertise, government contracting, folks that specialize in digital business, marketing and sales, a pretty well-rounded group. Next slide. Also, you know, this data is quite old. I think there is a new America's SBDC report, but this is the data that the SBDCs in Virginia use, demonstrating that annual sales growth and employment growth is far higher for companies that work with SBDC. As Stephen outlined, right, it's having mentors, having people that you connect with, and connecting to those tools and resources that really help folks grow and succeed and create jobs. Next slide. So this is overall, just an indication to show you visually what's been going on over the last 3 years. This is for, you know, our entire territory, which is, it mirrors the Go Virginia Region 9. But number of clients has increased substantially, as has the work hours that we're putting in. Impact is the money that has gone into the businesses that they've either put in themselves, it's loans, it's angel investment, various forms of capital. That is not including the CARES Act money. So these are really big numbers that we've been hitting across the territory. And a large number of new business starts. I think you're all well aware. A lot of folks decided this was the time to start a business, and we've seen quite a few in Fluvanna. Next. Thanks. These may be some familiar faces to you all. Just wanted to share a few pictures of your clients. They are winning in business and prizes. You all have a winning crew of pitch folks who are really making terrific gains, not only in their business models, but in really advancing and expanding beyond their territories. Next slide. So this is some Fluvanna numbers I thought you might like to see. I went all the way back to 2017 just to show a little bit of trend and what's happened for Fluvanna County companies. But you can see, you know, the numbers just are generally eking up and starting to stay up there. So we're showing here unique clients that are served. Number of startups, and I think I've shared this before, our definition is very tight. If a company has spent a dollar or received a dollar, and if they formed, we cannot count them as a startup. So we work with many more startups than are showed there, but those are those that we've recorded for your territory. And, you know, the jobs number last year, 27 new jobs created in this environment. We thought that was really a great number. Next slide. Capital received in Fluvanna also went up quite a bit. That's about close to $700,000 that was received by the companies that we worked with in Fluvanna. And we are working with mostly small companies in the territory currently. And just a little bit, you know, training has gone up and down. I'll show you shortly. There's a lot of training that happened here this year, so I expect those numbers will be back up. Next slide. So here it is. This is 2022, next year we'll present, we survey in January, so I'll present all of this year's data next year. But we did in-person 6 events in Fluvanna this year. We came and did some trainings, participated in some other activities, We held the Fluvanna Founders Series. We had a number of folks who actually got entrepreneurship certificates from that. We presented to the Rotary on the state of small business at their request, and of course, the Quad Tank Pitch Competition. You all had the most entries this year, and that was another really great showing. Next slide. Just some other activities that we do. You all know that we did that website jumpstart program where we built a number of websites, a number of them for Fluvanna County, Quad Tank, of course. And I like to show the website and the calendar because that website's about 100 pages deep at this point. It's an incredible amount of resources. So for those that don't want to come in for a meeting and they want to access information online, it's a very well-visited site. So it is a resource that we keep up and going and try to keep everything current for folks. Next slide. I think we're going to hit 90 training events for 2022. There's just been an incredible amount of desire for different programs, lots of marketing programs, 12 government contracting programs, SWAM certification 4 times a year, starting a business once a month, twice a month in some months when we have a whole lot of people that are looking to get into that class. So training is a big part of our activity, and we do now have a full-time events coordinator because of that. But again, you know, a lot of folks, they don't necessarily want those one-on-one meetings, but they want those trainings. And we are starting some cohort activities, which, you know, that's a really strong component of CIC, is those cohorts and those businesses get together, support each other, get to know each other. We just started doing that this past year, and we found that it's pretty successful. So we're doing a little bit more of that. Next slide. And this is how we do it. This has shrunk a little bit, and it will shrink some more for next year. We have, when we got the COVID money and we first really got ramping up in 2020, we hired a lot of contractors and just a lot of folks to come in and get us started as we started building the core of what would be the new SBDC operations. We have one more person to hire. We're actually moving to 2 full-time business advisors. And last year was the first year the SBDC ever had a full-time business advisor. So now we'll have 2. That's going to help us serve the territory better. And we still have a number of contractors. A few of those are going away when the digital resiliency program ends. So we're narrowing a little, but we will maintain a handful of experts. And then the bottom line there are the CBSBDC partners that we access free of charge. We have an international trade group. There's the ICAP program, which is Innovation Commercialization Assistance. There's 16 mentors there that we don't pay for, but we tap in quite often. Of course, there's the Small Business Supplier Diversity and others. These are all partners that we work with regularly to work with the clients. Next slide. This is our territory. I think you all know well a lot of your counterparts, right, in the other areas. Next slide. Is that the last one?
I think that's it.
That's the last one. Okay, good. So, yeah, so that's it. Wanted to blow through that in case you had some questions, but it's been a very busy, continues to be busy, hasn't slowed down for a second situation at SBDC.
Do we finance any of this?
You do, and I'm very grateful. Last year, you increased the amount that you were participating.
Increased.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Do you remember what those numbers were?
So the ask is, and I got to look at what it's going to be this year, but it's 0.577 cents per capita. That is over $12,000. You were at $2,750 for a few years. You came up to $10,000 last year.
Okay.
And the municipalities and SBA get us to about 60% of our budget. So we do still have a big gap, and that's with us knocking off close to $60,000 in contractors. We are trying to get as efficient as possible. That's why we're moving to those staff members. But yeah, we still have a pretty big gap. But we have some ideas.
I know this is a general question. You're not going to know the answer off the top of your head, but when you're talking about the ask, and what we jump from to any feel for where we're at in those 10 municipalities on our giving, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. So we applied that per capita rate in 2020, right when Stephen took us over and I got here, just to say, okay, let's just try to move this up a little bit. You all, you know, 12,000 would be fully at that amount, and almost everyone is at full funding or a little more because they're paying for additional programs and they pay us when we come and do special programs. But what we're also looking at is utilization. And in fact, we have a meeting, and Jennifer will be there on Friday, where we're talking about equitable distribution of SBDC resources, because there are counties that use much more of our resources right. than perhaps, you know, the
so
proportion.
So we're not fully funding what you ask.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But we're not. Where do we stand as far as utilization goes?
Very high.
Oh, okay.
As similar to CIC, you all are major users of SBDC. We see a lot of clients, and a lot of activity.
Right.
How closely do you work with the SBA itself?
Not very closely. We are a subcontractor to the contractor, which is the Virginia, well, actually George Mason University hosts Virginia SBDC, and then we're a subcontractor to that. We do have a 92-page document of the contract of rules that we need to follow. The wonderful thing about that is we have data, and we do keep a lot of data. We keep notes of everything that we do. It's all confidential, but this is why I can provide you with these numbers. We are a sister organization to things like the Ex-Im Bank, some of the other trade organizations that can really help our clients sometimes. So being an SBA affiliated office is really helpful. It does give us a little bit of power to kick some doors open for our entrepreneurs from time to time.
And I would add, it's almost impossible to work with the SBA.
We're really fortunate that funding happens every year. You know, we present to elected officials every year, and our clients will share success stories, so they at least provide that amount of funding to the SBA so it can be distributed. But also maybe worth noting, we get no funding from the state of Virginia, even though we're a statewide organization. We
and
are
what
not
percentage of your funding comes from localities then?
So about one-fifth is SBA, so two-fifths is the municipalities.
Okay. And what are the other two-fifths?
We were very fortunate. We had the CARES Act money, but when that went away, we also had a Go Virginia grant that's also over. There was a foundation that has come in and has provided us with $225,000 over 3 years, so that's $75,000 a year. We have some banks, and with Stephen's help, we've had some other foundations and folks that have given to the SBDC as well as CIC. And at this moment, we have about a $94,000 funding gap with those additional monies. We are talking to the municipalities. Some of them have already offered to pay for programs next year. So things that are beyond the base operations of the SBDC, they're providing funding for that, which will help to close that gap. We're also in conversations with a rather profitable private company that is interested in potentially donating to the SBDC. And we will send out a fundraising letter this year. We're going to try to reach out to those clients that maybe are doing okay and want to pay it forward so we can keep working with other small businesses.
And I know you spoke at the Go Virginia meeting, I believe, and in that meeting you sort of explained why that funding gap occurred. Maybe you can
SBDC, as I don't know how long all of you have been here, because I'm new to the group, but it was pretty small when I showed up, and there was a pretty small budget. And in order for us to get out into the community and serve better, we had to grow. So we did, and that's part of why there's a funding gap, but we also have determined, based on the numbers that we're seeing, this budget that we've put together is a really tight budget. We feel that our total budget, which is about $550,000, is about as small as we can go. That's still really tight, and we're slammed. Right? We actually could use another full-time person, but we just don't know where that money would come from. But yes, lots of business demand, and we thought it might slow down, but it's only increasing, and I think that's due to awareness.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, between sort of COVID and the use of these funds, and people exploring business opportunities, that awareness has had to have gone up significantly.
Yeah, and the client base is very broad now. Yeah. You know, and in fact, in Fluvanna, we have two high-growth tech companies that we're working with. Both of which are looking to raise equity money. So let's see if we can get them to really turn into some job makers.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all
so
much.
We do appreciate you coming out. Next up is F, the home ARP funding. Mr. Dahl.
Yeah, I'll start off with the presentation, then I'll have Ms. Hyland come up, and we also have Christine Jacobs with the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission here too. So let me kind of go through.
Yeah.
So again, the 2021 American Rescue Plan Act kind of provides the home ARP funds. So part of that Rescue Plan Act, it was a one-time allocation giving participating jurisdictions in the Home Investment Partnerships Program. So the allocation must be used to benefit individuals or families from the following qualifying population: homeless, at risk of homelessness, fleeing / attempting to flee domestic, dating, sexual violence, human trafficking, other populations experiencing housing instability, or veterans or families of veterans that meet one or more of a criteria. So the Home ARP award for the region was a little under $2.5 million. So TJPDC will retain a small amount of that for some planning development, as well as for administering the program. So then what's left is a little under $2.1 million is split evenly among the six participating jurisdictions for the TJPDC. So of that, Fluvanna County will receive Fluvanna County to implement has $347,000 to implement for the program. So localities can choose to fund supportive services, acquisition and development of non-congregate shelters, tenant-based rental assistance, development of affordable rental housing, and then also nonprofit operating and capacity building, both of which cap 5% of the total award. So from that, the localities can choose either to implement the funding directly, they can join other localities and pool the funding, or what we are submitting is probably the recommended thing to do, is choose an organization performing an eligible activity. So again, if localities intend to give preference to give preference to one or more qualifying population, that preference must be indicated in the plan and justified. Again, preferences that violate the Fair Housing Act, single-sex housing, non-congregate shelter, adult-only housing, blah blah blah, are not allowed. So with that, again, as we mentioned, going through some discussions and a lot of agencies that were involved, we looked at and had some discussions with the TJPDC and then Ms. Hyland with the Fluvanna Louisa Housing Foundation. They do some of this type of work already. The county doesn't have a housing authority or anything like that to perform these types of services. So it's something we don't necessarily have the capacity to implement the funding directly from the county. So with that, we had a meeting with Ms. Hyland to kind of come up and she already had a whole lot of thoughts and ideas for doing some of this. And then, you know, we had some conversations with Ms. Christine Jacobs with the TJPDC. Ms. Hyland had some conversations to make sure that kind of what we're potentially thinking of would kind of fit within the parameters. So I guess, Ms. Hyland, if you want to come up, I'll pull up your presentation and we'll kind of go through kind of the proposal that's being considered.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to see the board this evening. Thanks for having us again. We do have a couple of options. Go ahead, Mr. Bell. We have already implemented a previous design in Louisa County for senior housing. And it's a quadplex, so 4 one-bedroom units. What we would be proposing in Vivanna County is the same type of design with 2 of these quadplexes forming a courtyard area, so you would have a total of 8 one-bedroom units with a preference for seniors who live in Vivanna County already. It's actually, it's a typo, it should be 576 square feet per unit, but it offers independent living with low maintenance housing, wheelchair accessibility into the unit, 1-story with an accessible bathroom. We have a lot of seniors in the area where their homes are falling apart around them. We deal with this every day where we're trying to keep them in their homes as long as possible and repair them. But many of them are looking for something smaller. They only need a 1-bedroom unit. They don't want to maintain a whole house or several acres. And maybe they have a 2 or 3-bedroom house. They just don't have a need for that size of a unit anymore. What we would propose with the 8 one-bedroom units is land would be about 4 to 5 acres. We've had some discussions with Douglas Miles and what that would require as far as water and septic. We do have locations in the county where we can get water, but not really sewer, so it would require a septic drainage field and a special use permit. The cost estimate for building this type of a unit would be $650,000, not including the land and the water and septic. And we are also putting feelers out. We are a 501c3, so if anybody here knows of anyone with land who's looking to make a donation, we are putting our feelers out into the community. We think that would be a wonderful legacy for someone to continue on and donate land to the Housing Foundation for a senior build. So this is what it looks like. These are the actual plans from the Evergreen Place complex up in Louisa County. If you go through Louisa, and instead of taking 22 straight through, if you went off on Jefferson Highway 33, it's about a mile outside of town on the left. It has solar on it, so if you've been up in their area, you might have seen it. At the time, they were able to get a grant for solar, which is also something we could investigate. But you'll see it's really a lovely plan. We have hardy board siding on this, so it's very durable, very low maintenance, energy efficient, and you would be having 2 of these units, obviously, back to back, so they would form a common area. The one up in Louisa has a picnic table with a gazebo, so it'd be a nice, you know, outdoor area, would offer gardening, and improve the standard of living for those living in housing right now that is currently not warm, safe, or dry. As many of you know, we have just a huge number of requests for roofs that are actively leaking, floors that are caving in, HVAC units that are no longer working, plumbing and plumbing leaks. A lot of people calling now with Quest pipes that were installed about 15 years ago. Once they start failing, the whole plumbing in the house fails. So this is basically what it would look like with the courtyard design. We're proposing with home ARP funds of the $347,000 helping to fund this. We also have the CHOTO funds for this next year coming up through TJPDC. That will give us about $112,000 plus funds that we have left over from last year since we didn't have the build here. We have not been able to locate land. We do have a little bit extra that we can put into that, and Vivanna Louisa Housing Foundation funds of about $153,000, and we do have some flexibility with that. So that would bring us to the $650,000 required. You guys have questions so far?
You had said that the preference was that it was current Vivanna citizens. I thought I understood that it was going to be current Vivanna.
Yes, so what we would do, the selection criteria would be, first of all, they have to be income qualified. And from what I understand, right, Christine, we can have a preference for Vivanna residents, for seniors, for people, you know, we'll make a list of people who have homes that are falling apart around them, for their age,
we can have a higher preference for somebody who is 85 versus somebody who is 62. So yes, the preference, and of course, according to the location, it's going to be, we're striving to keep people in the community who want to live here longer, live out their lives here. They've always lived here. So we are actively looking, and that's part of this next one, potentially Fork Union, Palmyra, Kent Store, Bremo Bluff, Columbia. We want impact, you know, input from everyone here as to what the preference would be. But I do think Ms. Booker and Mr. Sheridan would have the areas with the greatest need for this type of a development. So it's going to feed on those areas. We want to serve the residents who are local to the building that we construct.
So is preference the same as criteria? In other words, the preference of that it is, but a criteria.
Criteria would be more stringent.
Okay, so it could end up being people who are not Fluviana citizens.
I'm going to say it would be highly like the only reason it could is if we didn't have people who applied in Fluviana. The rental units would be managed by the Fluviana Louisa Housing Foundation, and how we manage our current rental units is we do it by income. So we take their income, so they get $1,000 a month in Social Security, $300 or 30% is provided for rent. So instead of there being a market rent, we do it at per their income, so the 30% ratio. We also are looking at options where if they, a lot of the people we serve, they already own their homes. But they are falling apart around them. But if they want to sell their home to the Housing Foundation, we could give them lifetime rights to the one bedroom unit so that they are always, they always have a home for the rest of their lives and construct something around that. That way, too, we have another unit that we can rehab and put another family in. So that would solve two problems at once for us. We have a lot of families who need larger homes. We have a lot of older people in the community who have a larger home that they don't have need for the space anymore. Let's see.
And that's the same line being repeated as selection criteria there.
Yes.
I mean, you're just saying it a different way, but.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
It's a preference on the criteria.
Yes, it would be. And like I said, it just means if we had nobody from Fluviana, but that is right. That's who we're trying to serve here.
Right.
We're not trying to serve people from a different area.
So you built in Fluviana and somebody from Louisa gives you their house, you give them preference if we didn't have eight Fluviana residents.
Right. Right. But generally, when we build something, if we build in Fluviana County, we do it for Fluviana residents, the same thing in Louisa. Yeah, we try to draw a pretty strict line there. This would require some rezoning, potentially, by right we can do a duplex, but I think for the number of units, most of the county, we may require rezoning for this particular, wherever the land is.
Or special use.
A special use permit. Yes.
Mr. Miles, special use.
Special use, depending on the zone.
Well, one question or one thing in the statement I've had is sitting here thinking about this. If you get somebody that comes to you and says, hey, I want to stay in Fluviana County, and they've got 15 acres of land and a house, if you bought that house, separate 5 acres off and say, boom.
It's a great idea. Yep, that would be ideal.
You're sitting here, you put them right close to there. That would be them on their land.
Right.
Something you could say.
Yeah, that would be lovely. Yeah. And I have no doubt there are people out there who would find that beneficial.
But just circling back to this, the special use would just be for the sewer. It can't be for the density, though.
No, it would be. Mr. Miles, can you come up and speak on density really quick?
Yes, sir. Mr. O'Brien, you're kind of right in the majority of the areas that we're looking at for this type of housing. We have water, like aqua water or county water, but we don't have sewer. So as Kim said earlier, we'd be looking at drain field scenarios. But for density to get beyond a duplex, because you can create a duplex in A1 by right. It just takes additional county water line or aqua water. So the density, if you go into like R4 and get up to 2.9 dwelling units per acre, about 3 dwelling units per acre basically. But to do something like this, you have to go higher by using an SUP. to like double that to get like 6 to 8, you know, up to the amount of acreage or density that you would need for the number of units. So.
Yeah, I'm just confused because I thought that was like a zoning text amendment to do that as opposed to, you know, a special use permit just to increase density, but
that's right. And the zoning text amendment that you all have seen recently, that's another reason why we're looking at doing it, not only just for Zion Crossroads, but for affordable housing. And I think it's been so focused on Marina Point, unfortunately, and that's not the intent. So.
But right now we don't have that, so yeah. I mean, right, so if you wanted to do something like this on this type of acreage, you know, a special use permit would be needed to do
it. The only district that allows it now is R3, and that's the Colonial Circle model, where they went from the 279 at 2.9 dwelling units per acre up. They added the special use permit and got up to 325. So that amount allowed them to go higher and basically do the apartments. But we are striving. Also, we'd like to get some success with doing duplexes by right on county water lines, you know, aqua water lines. We do have a few duplexes that have been constructed around. People don't know it.
Well, guys, and this is something we'll solve later down the road. I mean, we're getting into the weeds now.
No, I just think
Ms. Highland needs to
agree.
Get
I agree.
Her thing done.
Sorry to interrupt you, Ms. Highland.
No, it's very helpful. I want you guys to understand that and what we're asking here and what it involves. I think the better informed everyone is, you understand what the concept is and what we're trying to bring to the county here and who we're trying to help here. Our greatest need, in my view, by the people that we serve, is in seniors. We're a heavily aging population, and we have, I think the numbers are a little low for the people in poverty, but I deal with that more every day, so maybe I'm a little bit tarnished in what I'm seeing. But I have a ton of elderly widows who are getting $800 or $1,000 a month, and they own their home. And they need help, though, with maintaining it. So we are, you know, putting our fingers in the dike as fast as we can to help them stay in their homes. But we do have a lot of homes where we can't solve things like flooring right now, because it gets too expensive. We get over our head, because usually it's not right just replacing the plywood, it's replacing the floor joists. And you know, the house is really not salvageable anymore. It's not at a value where it could be salvaged. So those are a lot of the places that we're looking at, where we want to help those residents to find a place to live that they can live for the rest of their days. They can stay in the community that they've always lived in. They have safe and stable housing. We can then demolish the original house that's on their lot and put up another single-family home for a family. We have the capacity to do that. We're working with other organizations as well. Overton McGee has offered that they have NSP funds, Neighborhood Stabilization Program funds, to help with events like this. So we have a lot of different things that we can pull from that will help with a lot of the blight in the community, a lot of the very poor living conditions that people are under, to make homes more livable, help our seniors age in place. And with this, they may not be aging in the exact same place, but in a little bit better place, hopefully. And we can take care of some of these affordable issues, which I know we talked about that term being weaponized, that it's a difficult term nowadays. You know, we're just trying to help our local Fluvanna residents live better, live in a safer environment, not have to deal with leaking roofs every day. So this is ideal that this money has come at this time. I think it's perfect for Fluvanna County and our needs. It's coming down through the Thomas Jefferson Planning District, and we can use it as we see fit. And we thought this would be an ideal time for a project like this. It's not going to be a requirement for the county to utilize their funds. The board just has to approve that we are able to receive it and that we have a plan. Christine has to be able to bring a plan to HUD very soon and let them know how each county is going to administer these funds and what type of a project we intend to pursue with these funds.
And then so kind of some of the next steps, you know, one, you know, speaking with Ms. Jacobs, you know, we wanted to have some conversations first with Ms. Highland and the board to see, is the board willing to go in this direction? Ms. Jacobs, is there anything formal you need from the county? I mean, is there a resolution or?
Yeah, it doesn't need to come in this meeting. It can come
coming one of your future meetings, we will then need to do, through the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission, we will need to do a formal public hearing on the entire plan for the region. And the allocation plan, or they call it the annual action plan, needs to be submitted to HUD no later than March.
Yeah.
And so we have several months to get the draft ready, to get it out before the public, to get feedback. So the sooner we can get from our jurisdictions what their preferences are, the sooner we can get moving on creating that draft.
So again, the first thing is meeting with Ms. Hyland, meeting with the board, and then we kind of go back and kind of just meet again with the TJPDC for this, and then we would come forward with the appropriate resolution to formally say, yes, we're, you know, the county is moving forward with the Ana Luisa Housing Foundation to be the recipient of these funds and implement whatever type of plan we're looking at doing, if it's this, if it's something slightly different or whatever the board wants.
And the property doesn't need to be identified?
No.
Or potential properties don't need to be identified?
No.
Mr. Dahl, have you spoken with other
jurisdictions?
Louisa's.
Like Habitat for Humanity. They work in Flavanna. Have you spoken with them and said, you know, do you have a plan if we could, with this $347,000? Because they do an awful lot of repairs, and they've built homes in Houchins Place. So I think you need to do a little more research, or we do.
We're actually the designated recipient for the home funds. We do work with Habitat. We built four of the homes in Houchins Place. Two of them we just sold this past month to first-time home buyers. So we do work alongside Habitat, and if we have an opportunity to collaborate with them, I know Robin Bowling is always willing to collaborate with us. But the reason it's either Piedmont Housing Authority Alliance, correct, or Flavanna Luisa Housing Foundation are the designated recipients for Flavanna County.
So this American Rescue Plan Act actually has already donated the money to you?
It's allocated to the region through the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission. So they have the funds. The funds are then split evenly amongst the six jurisdictions. And so that's where each jurisdiction has 347 and some change to implement as they see fit.
So this board really doesn't have much say. It's either this or nothing?
Well, it's either this or unless the board wants, it's either Flavanna Luisa, it's either Piedmont Housing, or the board wants the county to try and be a housing authority of some sort, which we don't have the expertise or the capability or the knowledge to do anything like that.
This goes to your question. So did I understand you to say that these are the only two organizations operating in Flavanna that are qualified to receive these funds?
Ms. Jacobs, maybe you can...
And yeah, please step to the microphone so we can hear you.
Currently, the Home Consortium, which consists of the six jurisdictions that are a part of the consortium, have what's called a cooperation agreement. And in that cooperation agreement, that's what splits the funding in six parts. It also identifies in the cooperation agreement the organizations that are the subrecipients of the annual home funds, not home ARP. However, if you decide to use one that is not part of already in that agreement, you would have to go through more of a formal RFP process. So you would have to then issue a proposal, you would have to seek proposals, and then you would have to identify who your subrecipient is going to be if it's not one of those already identified in the cooperation agreement. And one of our six jurisdictions is going to do that process.
Well, it also seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's already an underserved need to meet this type of housing to begin with, and regardless as to which organization does it, you're not really, to Ms. Hyland's point, competing with each other because the demand is so high that it doesn't really matter. So it's not that we're taking money away from
Habitat.
You know, we're really supplementing the process from that standpoint. I mean, if you just do the math on the numbers, as I think Ms. Hyland highlighted, you know, you're talking about folks that are living in their home, they're living on Social Security, probably sub $1,500 a month in many cases. There's nowhere else that they can go and spend $300 to $450 a month to live.
They would qualify for Habitat housing.
And we're not deciding tonight where it goes.
Yeah,
they would qualify.
We're just getting the presentation on
Well, I mean, but I guess a little bit is if the board says we don't want to move forward with Fluvian and Louisa, then staff would need direction that, okay, well, if the board wants us to do an RFP and go through and say, okay, well, you know, Fluvian County wants to build X and we want all these companies or developers to give us a proposal for what it's going to cost and what their plan is to do that, that's what we'd have to do.
And costs are only climbing quickly, and so those delays only add to the expense, if you would, from that standpoint.
So I was thinking in the way that if Habitat for Humanity can repair homes, they might be able to stay in their
home. Habitat for Humanity don't repair homes anymore.
Yeah, we repair the homes.
The only one that I know, Habitat, they wanted to, and they started one time. But they don't repair.
They're the ones that come into homes now
they
and do repairs.
They do
the housing foundation.
Louisa does. Offer.
Actually, go to the next slide, Eric. I kind of put this up one down further. Sorry.
One more.
Yeah. So this kind of gives you an idea. This is repairs just in Fluvanna County, and the first year that's listed there is the year before I came on. We did about $47,000 worth of repairs in Fluvanna County. And we got about $20,000 worth of grants. The first year I was in, we did $126,000 in Fluvanna, and we got $75,000 of it granted. And last year we did $133,000 in Fluvanna and $92,000 granted. So we've had a 283% increase in repairs just in Fluvanna in the past 2 years, and 460% increase in grants. We did about $320,000 worth of overall repairs in both counties last year. We're on track to do about $450,000 this year. And the last time I had a request of you all was back in August to do a letter of support for the Virginia Department of Health SWAP grants, septic and well assistance. I just received I haven't been able to share this one with anybody yet. We just received an email this week that preliminarily we have been awarded the full amount.
Yeah.
So that's $300,000 wow. For septic and well.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Now, I've been on Fluvanna Louisa board for a long time, even before I got on this board, because my husband was one of the original people starting it with Evergreen. And we just had a meeting for the week, and I must say that Ms. Holland has done a fantastic job. I met a little lady the other day at the football game said, "Ms. Booker, I'm going to be buying my own house." She used to rent from me, and I pushed her out and said, "You need your own
succeeded.
Home."
She succeeded. We got it this last
year. So now
week.
She
yeah.
has her a home now. And they went in and built a home for a man that was blind and his wife. He's deceased now, but she's still there. So I know all the work that they've been doing over the years. I had a question. You said there would be the 30%. Can anyone get in a duplex with more than 30% of the medium income?
Yeah, so we will qualify. It's up to 60%.
Is it? I thought I saw somewhere
yeah.
it was 60%.
Home is generally anybody under 80%, so we do have some leeway. We just generally serve people who tend to be under 30%.
Okay.
So part of the 30% you saw was what we take for rent is 30% of their income.
Of course, that was not the AMI.
Right, but generally we do serve people who are under 25-30% AMI.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
okay.
That's just what the
but you all can set preferences for what
right.
AMI level you're targeting.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so go back up one slide. So this is the selection criteria. I'm sorry, it's a little bit crowded in here, but it does give you a higher, so if you look right in the middle, it says financial barriers, AMI.
Mm-hmm.
So you increase the amount of points
right.
you give someone who is below 30%. So those people are the ones we're mostly targeting. So the different targets is what we give the biggest percentage or the biggest points to. So at the end, I kind of compared it to somebody who applied from Charlottesville who didn't meet our criteria all the way at the bottom. They only got 3 points. But there was Miss Maggie May from Fork Union. She's 90, and she got 14 points because she fits that the income requirements. She has some a home that she wants to sell us in order so that she can have the one-bedroom unit that she can stay in and stay in the community. So I just wanted to give you guys an idea of how that actually functions.
So if somebody came from a different area, yeah, that would be a low preference. Younger age, higher income. We're targeting the right people because we're going to get more applicants than we have houses. The last house we built, we got 28 applications for one house.
So a question I had when you and I thought of when you and I talked earlier, and I think it kind of goes to what Trish is asking. So let's say it's not MACA, but to the question of repair, why do this, especially if you're talking about potentially buying them or rehab of what mm-hmm. they already had, mm-hmm. if rehab is an option after they're out of it, why a rehab or remodel is not an option instead of building another location with that same money?
It can be. So typically they're in a larger house than what they need with more land, so part of it would be a maintenance issue for them. Much of the rehab work would be quite extensive on most of these homes. So you're talking about, you know, either complete demolition or, you know, taking out walls, floors, you know, a complete, you know, beyond a gut job. There are, you know, 3 to 5 systems at least that are failing in the home. Lack of insulation. So it's something where people really, it's not suitable to live in anymore. Yeah.
Well, and if you're at 30% AMI and you're living in your old home, you don't have the money to keep up with the repairs,
right?
And pay for your utilities,
right?
I mean, one, if you think about it, if you're on $1,000 of Social Security and your heat pump goes out, you know, that's almost 3/4 of a year of your income just to replace
it. And you know what? That's easy for us to replace, actually, a heat pump or a roof or, you know, electrical repairs and septic. It's most of these people have multiple systems
right.
that have failed. So if we could just replace the roofs, we'd be in great shape.
And the economy of scale is not ideal either because,
right.
you know, the ongoing cost for them to be in that home is
right.
such that you're perpetuating the problem versus if they're in an efficient, quad-based, community-based support system like what you're suggesting here, then the support level is much higher and their ability to have a higher quality of life is significantly increased.
And it's a safer unit too for the elderly.
Yes, yes. So these are, yes, these are wheelchair accessible, one story. They are outfitted with the showers for roll-in, grab bars. They're completely ADA compliant and set up to be functional for a senior to age in place as long as possible.
I mean, really, it's impressive that they can be built for $650,000, not counting the land and the water.
Right.
So still,
right.
let's say it's $800,000.
Yeah, and we're looking to reduce that cost as much as possible by having volunteer labor, working with other community businesses to have things donated. We have Beck Cohen that's just donated 3 units to us. And they, you know, these are the types of things they're looking to do and get some publicity out of and get some marketing. Lowe's is nearby. We have, I'm blanking on the place up in Zion's.
Better
Living. Thank you. Yeah. So we've got some building ACE. You know, there's construction type of companies in the area who are interested. We have a ton of contractors around who really do wonderful work helping us out.
So we got two more. Things to go through, guys. We're averaging about 30 minutes a piece.
Yeah, I want to commend you on creating that scorecard, creating criteria that get people to qualify. That's better. It's easier for us to understand who we're helping.
Good. Glad to hear that.
Yeah. So I guess the big question is, you know, how would the board like for staff to move forward with this? I mean, are we gearing it? Are we going to move forward with a proposal that Ms. Highlands proposed for Fluena Louisa, or do you want us to do something different?
I suggest we move forward with this.
I do too.
We already have definitely. 3 people nodding yes, 4. So we're all in agreement on that. One last thing, just throw it on your radar. We tried to get together to talk about CERCAP last year, and we got snowed out a couple times, so we're a little bit behind. Of course, you know, some people decide to get on scooters and break themselves up this summer. So, yeah, I won't call any names. But if we can get back together sometime, and because I'm going to be seeing those guys this
Kenny
week.
Rogers and I spoke this week about it, so we're trying to get him back on track.
Let's see if we
can
get back together and mm-hmm. start talking about that.
Yep, we need to
thank
get Columbia
so much.
Taken care of. Thank
so
you.
So really Ms. Highland, we'll coordinate and we'll with Ms. Jacobs and kind of get whatever we need to get moving forward for paperwork.
Great.
Thank you.
right. Thank you all. Appreciate the time tonight.
All righty. Next up is 2023 reassessment update. Mr. Willis, thanks for being patient. And I see you're bringing a hoodlum with you.
And so Mr. Willis, I basically... I'll say this, Ms. Solise transposed a lot of your information from the report that was in the board package and what was sent earlier today into these slides. So like I said, we got pretty much, you know, almost word for word some of your information.
And I was here a few weeks ago to present to you a summary of the market study that compares sales versus current sales values. And I told you I would come back and give you some updates on how the numbers were moving or changing for the different areas, so that's what I wanted to do. You know, in spite of the interest rate creeping up, it went up another 0.75% today, I think. It's probably higher than it's been in 20 years. But the demand here in Fluvanna is still good, from what I see. The median sale price the third quarter of this year compared to last year increased 18%. And it did the year prior to that. So that tells you something. Inventories on the market have increased. There's more inventory out there for sale. The number of sales third quarter of this year versus last year is down 16%. But the values are still very stable and increasing.
So just to kind of go through some of Mr. Willis's stuff. So again, this is class two single families, less than 20 acres. And again, on each of these, you have the map here, which has Fluvanna County, and you have this blue line, which kind of breaks it up into above the blue line, which he considers neighborhood two, below the blue line, which is considered neighborhood one.
And that also goes hand in hand with the market study that we did. Neighborhood one basically is going to be zones 4, 5, and 6 in that market study that I had outlined. And it's a different demand for property in that area versus zone 2.
So again, looking at this overall, and correct me if there's anything, like I said, taking this right from your report, the overall change in market value for the county is a 12% increase, and this would include Lake Monticello.
Yes, that's an overall number. Yeah. Yes.
So under neighborhood 2, and just some clarification, it says 13. Land in this class, that means, is that property?
13.
It's 13%?
Yeah.
After we ran the numbers, it is closer to 13%.
It's closer to 13, okay. So neighborhood 2, it says land in this class will generally increase approximately 5%, with this generally occurring in neighborhood 2.
All right, and that's not necessarily land. That would be overall increase in parcels, for all the parcels.
All parcels.
Yes.
And then in neighborhood 2, from your data, from your report, excluding Lake Monticello, you're showing an overall increase of 11.6%, but dwellings will increase average of 15%.
Correct.
So that's...
This report I sent today breaks it down.
Yeah, and we have that information on the next page. This includes some of the information you provided pre the board package going out, and then also...
Gotcha.
So then...
And the increase generally is going to be in the structure or the dwelling value itself. There will be very moderate increases in land values, and they will be in tracts that are 10 acres and less. But it'll be moderate increases, if any.
So this is the information that Mr. Willis sent today, and I emailed to the board. I'm not sure if you had a chance to look at it. But so again, looking at Lake Monticello, excluding golf and waterfront lots, overall increase is 17%. Dwellings will increase 18.5%.
I'd like to point out also the increase on dwellings there is a little higher because one-story dwellings are going to increase a little bit more than two-story. And there are a lot of very modest one-story homes in Lake Monticello in the interior lots. So that's why that increase is a little bit higher.
Lake Monticello Golf Course overall increase is 17.6%. Dwellings will increase average of 19.8%.
Yes, the golf course has been doing pretty well the last couple of years compared to the few years prior to that.
And then the last one, Lake Monticello Waterfront overall increases 11%. Dwellings will increase average of 15.3%.
Yes. And on the water, there are more Class A type homes than there are the interior lots.
Well, and the numbers in terms of percentages don't really tell the whole story.
It doesn't. It doesn't. Right. It's just a number.
No, I know, but you look at it and you say, oh, waterfront 11%, but waterfront lots assessed at $200,000.
And so I'm glad you understand.
$20,000 increase. Exactly. Where a golf course lot is $50,000, so that's only a $10,000 increase. And yep. A regular lot is $24,000, so that's only a.
So you understand the numbers. You understand the numbers. That's
good. Well, since I live on the water, I know exactly how much it costs.
And you know, the lake is doing well. The
lake is doing well.
It is. And but it's not local buyers typically on the water either. It's not local people buying.
Right. No.
For the problem. But the interior lots, I think it's a mix.
Yeah, no, it's totally a mix now.
Mm-hmm. And then, which is good.
It is. Great place to live.
And then looking back at Class 2 single family, less than 20 acres, Neighborhood 1, basically those below the blue line. And then overall increase is 6%. Dwellings will increase average of 11.6%.
Mm-hmm. And again, most of your increase overall is going to be within your structure or dwelling value. And I spoke with Mel also, and maybe at some point we can post this on the website.
Was that one from today?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Just for the public, I mean, it's...
Yeah, we pretty much pull that information, so these presentations are posted on the website,
right.
So...
And again, you know, these are averages. Some will be more, some will be less, if you know how the numbers work.
And then looking at other properties, and then please feel, like I said, this is pulled from your previous report, Class 5, which is in A1, which are properties 20 to 99 acres,
mm-hmm.
includes developed and undeveloped parcels. Overall change in market value for the county is 5% increase.
Correct. And most of that, you know, there's a lot of vacant properties out there that will not change in value, large acreage tracts. And that's just a number.
Yep, Class 6, A1, 100 acres and up. Again, it includes developed and undeveloped. Overall change in market value for the county is a 6% increase. And then the last one, Class 4, commercial industrial. As Mr. Willis noted, value change will vary, some increasing, some decreasing, some not changing.
And there's limited sales activity, of course. And it's hard to support changing a value either way if you can't support a reason why.
To that sort of point, and to the questions that were asked at the public hearing,
mm-hmm.
which I thought were really good questions,
mm-hmm.
Or points that were being made, my understanding is that we basically value the land, you know, industrial land is valued at $100,000 if it's zoned that way, and the commissioner can correct me, commercial industrial is more or less priced at the same point. But it had been mentioned that some of the land was priced at, say, $16,000. Is that the case? I mean, is that due to land that is in a commercial area but hasn't had its zoning changed?
I would have to have.
I think that's where some of that confusion maybe comes in, because when I've looked at the values, you know, yes, there are lots, say, at Science Crossroads that are mm-hmm. industrial zoned, vacant, at $100,000 an acre, and then there's a property right next to it that's agricultural and valued at $16,000 an acre. Or, you know, $4,000 an acre.
And if that's the case, if it's zoned A1 versus industrial, yes, that's proper.
But somebody might look at that and think that that is the commercial land. But you're not doing any NOI studies on the commercial properties themselves, or are you?
We analyze a lot of data.
You do.
But, you know, locally, I look at data that occurs here.
Right.
Because I can't support it if it's, you know, closer into Richmond or into Charlottesville. I can't compare that data.
But so you're not measuring, which was, you know, again, sort of the question that was being asked is, if we've increased the availability of commercial property, and yes, we've approved the zoning, but the properties haven't been built, there is not in your assessment process a thing that says, well, there's now more commercial property available, even though that it's not been put into use.
If it's been rezoned, it's been assigned a value based on its highest and best use, yes.
But that's for the land. So it's rezoned and the land is now priced at that value, but
right.
It's not priced in comparison to another property right next to it. So in other words, you know,
well, it should be. It will typically have the same acreage price, but it may have an adjustment for being undeveloped.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, there's a lot there or not, but you're going to price, like, again, say we're looking at the shopping malls, one at Zion's Crossroads and one at Fork Union and
right.
one at Lake Monticello. How are you, and let's say each one of those shopping malls has four units in it, and maybe, you know, one of them has a vacancy. Are you measuring that in any way in terms of your assessment?
I would take that into consideration,
yes. You would, okay.
Yes.
All right.
So let's talk about just the dirt, the lot part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I call Lake Monticello Beltway, and let's say it's B1. The amount per acre, is that going to be fairly consistent?
Should be, yes.
So, and I had it pulled up on my phone. I came here. There's a property on Lake Monticello Road, Route 618, that shows it's Dusty Christian's property. It's where they're building his shop for his earth moving equipment. You know, that's the business he's in.
What's it close to?
It's almost across the street from the self storage, but the new self storage.
I know what you're talking about.
Well,
they cleared the land last year.
I think they're just clearing. They just cleared probably about 3-4 months ago. I think.
They got the zoning like April of last year, and that property shows today as B1, which it didn't until recently. And it shows as on the county website is like $96,000. It came out to like $6,800 an acre, which B1 property
that's,
around Lake Monticello Beltway is not
$6,800. If that's the property I'm thinking of, it's been changed for the reassessment.
Okay.
I was going to ask too, how current is the zoning on the GIS? Because that's where I've been looking quite a bit also in doing comparisons.
It's not always current from my recent understanding specifically about that property.
But I think the record shows, well, I knew that it was rezoned. If that's what I'm thinking of, it's been repriced.
How
based on zoning.
To that question, how current is the zoning on Vaminet as an example, right?
It's current. Might be an isolated issue that
on the record?
You know, frankly, if we find something that's not accurate, we fix it.
Yeah, they change it pretty quick.
In combination with the county planning office. Particularly if you do a rezoning and we pick that up, because, you know, land values are set in effect of January 1st, and then once you rezone it, if you do, or do an SUP, then that next following January, we'll pick that
increase. So that's probably part of what you're seeing, as it was previously agricultural, and now...
It didn't show as B1 until a couple months ago.
Okay, the piece of land that
to
zone
you
in closer to that piece of land, you know where the new housing development went in right across from the main gate?
I do.
Then go back up towards the church where the new self storage things are. It's right across the street. They just cleared the land probably a month and a half, 2 months ago.
That value has had a method change. It's now commercial. Price is commercial for the first either 1 or 2 acres, then it's residual commercial. But it has been changed, yes.
But to put the point, the question to rest, it's very accurate. You know, will you find a potential error on 16,000 parcels, maybe, probably, but if we do, we fix it quickly. But when you rezone something or you do an SUP on a piece of property, upzone particularly, even if you are downzoning it, we make that change and then it becomes effective for assessment on January 1st of the following, the following January. So if something was changed this past August, it becomes effective this one January going forward.
So it should be considered in the reassessment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So we try to point that. We try to bring that to their attention.
In the case of this property?
Yeah.
I asked a bunch of questions about that property earlier in the year, I want to say early September, as were citizens asking me questions about that, and I was asking staff. It wasn't, and it was saying, well, it was said, well, it's just kind of on the back end within the company doing the software and so on. However, I think it wasn't until September 19th that it was reported to your office that the zoning had changed, and so we didn't collect this year on B1 zoning on that, although I think it was like April of last year that property, the zoning had been awarded. So we didn't collect in this past year, and I started off, I saw Dusty, who owns it, and I said, hey, did you get a change in your tax bill?
Easily checked and corrected.
I'm sorry?
Easily checked and adjusted as may be necessary.
I had sent an email asking about this, and I didn't, not you, but didn't hear anything back.
Yeah, if you didn't hear anything back from me, you didn't send it to me.
It wasn't you. No, that's what I said. I didn't send it to you.
Gotcha.
It was the staff. And I didn't see, maybe you sent it and I missed it. But what is the system? Is it literally is it planning contacting you all and saying, hey, wanted you to know that that has changed? Because
in effect, yes. So Mr. Miles' office would contact mine. We work with, we handle the FAMINET piece of it, and we both collectively work with the company that does the GIS, mapping for us, and we pick it up on our records, which then Mr. Willis and them get when they do their next reassessment. We'll pick it up if it's a midterm, in other words, if it wasn't this January, which is the reassessment, if it was January of 22, we'll ask them to do a special assessment on it based on the rezoning / SUP, more intensive use. So trust me, we'll check on that.
And I also look at your zoning on your county GIS to try to confirm.
And you look at the layers as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, there are some properties that are zoned A1 or R1 that the highest and best use is definitely industrial or commercial. I just see it in doing my reviews.
Well, when you say best use, I mean, until the property is rezoned,
mm-hmm.
we don't have any control over that. I mean, yeah,
right.
there are
right.
literally properties at Zion's Crossroads that are in land use.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're literally there, and so
right.
the person's paying a very nominal tax base,
mm-hmm.
and one of the points that I've tried to make is that, if we as a board don't have policies in place that discourage that in a way,
right.
yes, land use has its purposes, but
yeah.
if it's in targeted growth areas, is land use appropriate in that particular location?
Right.
Then in essence, aren't we subsidizing the and I know you're going to say you get the clawback.
That's a good point.
And subsidizing,
Mr. Brown, I want to make sure
that growth, because if I can hold on to a piece of property for 15 years, knowing that
the wheels of government
move very slowly.
But please keep in mind, we collectively put plans and made some changes in plans. If you're in the Zion's Crossroads planning area, you can be upzoned and stay in land use at
right.
the direction of the board
right.
as
yeah.
an encouragement to get our landowners to consider
converting
and
to aid in that process. Yeah,
yeah, it's an interesting dynamic if you're in that planning area. But
and it wasn't meant as
exactly
a criticism.
Right.
That's not a bad policy.
Yeah,
no,
it was not meant as a criticism. It was just meant when you use the term the best use.
Highest and best
use.
How You know, how is that, you know, as an assessor, I'm sure you see that everywhere, you know, but is the way we're dealing with it relatively common? Or is it not common, I guess, is maybe what I was asking from that.
It's not uncommon.
Not uncommon.
No.
Yeah. To your point, you're exactly right. If there's a property zone day one that's sitting in a, you know, fairly commercialized area, highest and best use probably isn't soybeans. You know, it's probably a, you know, a commercial development. But be that as it may, that's where we are right now. But there are a couple of points I wanted to make that y'all need to be aware of, just not diverting, but getting back. I know this is on average 13% increase, and that's a little higher than what we've had, but it's been a pretty incredible couple of years for real estate, particularly residential. But just to kind of give you a benchmark, I was reading an article today, another county that's rural like we are, they deferred for 4 years. And again, I'm trying to once again say that y'all are just absolutely doing the right thing on a two-year schedule. And Warren County, they had a four-year reassessment, and it went from 19 to 23. And theirs is a 40% increase. That's what they're looking at. And I can't imagine what their assessor hearings will be like or board equalization. So just for food for thought, it's higher than, well, it's exactly, I think, what we talked about 15%-ish ballpark. The mailings, so that you know, all the citizens in your area, Randy didn't think they're going to go out about between the 14th and the 18th of this month. So in another couple of weeks, they'll hit the mail, hit the mailboxes, and they'll call us all, you know, and say, man, what in the world happened? Well, everything's gone up. What's important to note is it'll have a phone number on there, and you can pass this on, anybody were to ask you about it, to call to make an appointment with Mr. Willis and Company for an assessor hearing or review. And they're very supportive in doing it by telephone, by internet, or even in person if it may.
Whatever convenient for the property owner.
And that's important because I think we will have some people that'll be asking this year when we're talking 17, 16, 18% increases.
It'll be the same ones I spoke with 2 years ago.
It's also kind of...
Primarily, which is okay.
Without belaboring it, this increase will have a significant impact potentially on your second half revenue for this fiscal year. When we, you know, the Treasurer's Office collects in June, it'll be based on these reassessment numbers. And on the 13% across the board average, that with land use being taken out, these are real numbers. I just ran it today to kind of give you an idea. If the tax rate did not change, and I suspect it will, if it stayed at 87, it would be a significant increase in revenue that is not built into your budget this year. And when I say significant, it's
130.
Almost 1.7. And so
that is what I ran today.
Yeah, 13. I thought that's what you told me. 13% average increase. So if you take that math and just, and of course, you told me for half the year, but that's a 1.7, you know, increase in your collections for June 7th, and that does not include any new houses that may be CO'd or built from effectively this December through next May. You know how we pick up houses as we go along. So food for thought for your real estate tax rate as y'all, you know.
Yeah, for this year, since it is a reassessment, we've got to do a couple different special public hearings as part of the budget process. We have to advertise what the equalized rate is. Basically, we're getting X amount of revenue currently. What is the rate? What is the equalized tax rate to get that same amount of revenue? And, you know, just nominally, I mean, just talking about that, I mean, it could be 5 cents potentially.
Eric and I looked at it today. It's just a touch over 5 cents, so equalization rate. Without the new houses, we'll pick up. And you know how I always try to work those new COs in up until about March, you know, right before y'all have set the rate. So you're looking at about, you know, 80, 81 and a half. Equalization rate, 82.
Yeah, our tax rate is becoming more competitive with others around us.
Yeah, and that's without having to impose a technology fee, which some of our neighbors do, but they don't mention that to you. They do that, like Goochland, you know, at 28 cents per 100 technology fee if you live in the eastern port of Goochland.
And water?
58 cents per 100 doesn't tell the whole story when they hit you with the technology fee, but for what it's worth. I think you'll be looking at equalization rate, Mr. Don Alfredo, but about 81, 81 and a half-ish.
That doesn't include personal property.
That absolutely does not include personal property, which we think will go up about 5 to 7% again.
Which is way lower than what it's been going up.
It went up 34% last year.
And it's gone up what?
Well, the numbers have not come in, Ms. Booker, but we've been briefed about 5 to 8%. But I'm going to look at that real carefully.
I thought they were actually going down. I thought the used car values were starting to equalize.
Not yet. As I mentioned, without belaboring it, there's still a pretty big shortage of new vehicles, 4 million unit requirement nationally per year. It went from about 1.7 in 22. They think that's going to be about 2.4 million in 23, and then almost 3.5 in 24. They're really anticipating it's going to be 25 before the new car market catches up with demand, driven primarily by lack of components. We all know that. So
a young lady teaches with me, they were looking at a certain type of car. They were told, okay, we can order that. 8 months, it'll be here. So they quickly changed, and they still had to wait 3 months.
Yeah, if you look on TV, they'll give you, put you on a list and give you priority, but they won't give you the new car because it's not made yet. We do have to look at, as y'all may know, this is the 23 reassessment, and so we'll have to be, Mr. Dahl and I talked today about getting ready for the 25, 27. We'll have to look at an RFP for that contract to be done with this budget cycle.
And with the real estate market, there are a lot of moving pieces currently. And if anybody could look into a crystal ball and tell you what it's going to be 6 months from now, who knows with the interest rate.
And then just on the screen, there's just some, Mr. Willis provided some data, comparative data, second quarter 2022 statistics, the same period of 2021. And then third quarter 2022 statistics versus the same period of 2021.
And we basically look at market activity through the third quarter.
Yep.
I do a lot of driving. If a for sale sign goes up,
it just doesn't
sit there very long before someone says.
Average days on the market is 19 in the third quarter. It was 12 this time last year, but that's still pretty tight.
And I remember when it was like 50 to 60 days.
And think about that with, frankly, Ms. Highland's presentation. Who would have thought the average median house price would have been $360,000 in Air County, you know? So they do great work.
And it'll go back down.
It'll go back down with interest rates bumping.
And buyers, new buyers in today's market, their only hope is the rate will decrease in the next few years. They can refinance. That's their only hope. Unfortunately, because my daughter's looking to buy in Raleigh. She just purchased in Northern Virginia last year, and they're looking to relocate to Raleigh. But they hate to go to a 7.5% rate versus the current 3% that they borrowed money on. So it's tough. It's tough for young people.
This is a little off subject, but since we touched on it, otherwise, I'm going to have to bring it up later in the meeting, because a citizen did bring that question up to me about the value of that property and how it in the Dusty Christian property, and said, well, if it happened with that one, that the value, that the adjustment wasn't made that reflected in how much taxes he paid, then how do they know, how do we know it's not plenty more? And I have confidence that you are tight on that.
Well,
but a citizen is right in asking that question.
Yeah.
On half of
sure.
One.
Yeah.
And so I want to understand, be it whether you email it to the board so we can all understand, or whether we say it here, what that process is, where when it goes from here and it gets a thumbs up, it goes to B1, how that ends up being a tax rate on the other, you know, on the other end of it.
Sure. Let me double check the couple of three things there. One, that's not that many rezonings that are done on a annual basis,
yeah,
and it should easily have been picked up. So we'll first check to make sure that it was rezoned, or it maybe the SUP, I believe you're saying it got rezoned. And so we simply go back and see when that rezoning became effective. Mm-hmm. And this question occasionally comes up with respect to not the rezoning, but where there may have been something that was over-assessed or potentially under-assessed. The county has the authority to go back 3 years and issue a refund if somebody, let's say we came out and estimated the size of your house and missed it by 500 square feet, and you caught that at some point. County can issue a refund for those overpayments for up to 36 months. At the same time, if something was under-assessed, under-taxed, it can also issue a supplemental bill and charge you. And we have had to do that, not often, but on a rare case, something like that comes up where, you know, there might have been a building permit that didn't get picked up because it just, for whatever reason.
Sure.
Doesn't happen often, but it does happen. So it can be fixed. Mm-hmm. It can up to the 36-month point.
And an owner is not going to notify us typically if it's under-assessed, yeah, unless they're getting ready to sell.
If they're getting ready to sell, they bring it to your attention.
Yes.
I just want to know the system.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. A great question.
I made a note.
A to Z.
Yeah. I thought at some point we purchased a Munis module that was part of the planning department that was supposed to help with these kinds of things.
Well, yeah, but that's more for like that's more for them going in the field. I mean, the Munis module is not connected to the Commissioner of Revenue's assessment software.
Yeah. What frequently can happen is you bought a property that may have been on the books for a long time, and it was a 50-year-old survey, and it said plus or minus. And when you have it resurveyed, for whatever reason, you find out it wasn't the acreage that it had been taxed for a large number of years. The worst case I've seen was one that was a little over 50 years old. I won't belabor it, but it was taxed for more acres. The survey said 50 acres plus or minus. Actually said 55. And when it was eventually surveyed, when it was given to a grandson, and they cut a lot off, it was 35. I mean, it's a big change, big difference. Mm-hmm. Mr. Sheridan.
But your record reflects what's on the deed.
Correct, what's in the courthouse. So yes. how we addressed that was, there was a 20-acre error. And so we wanted to give, I would like to have been able to give back more than the previous 3 years, but we could not. Roy Perkins, Mike, and you lived on Perkins Road. He bought it and came home World War II. It was 55 acres plus or minus. And when he gave it to his grandson, I tell him Perkins Road, that 5-acre lot, man, it was hard to tell them. You know, they paid for tax. We were able to give him a 3-year refund, but the other 47 years we didn't. The flip side of that is we've had people build things that didn't get picked up. Something happened in 94. And the landowner did everything right, but the county just, you know, mistakes do occasionally happen. Didn't pick up the property, the house. And when they were dividing up the property by will between some siblings, the landowner came and said, hey, you know, I think I'm going to talk to you about the house tax or something. Anyway, we did have to give him a bill for the previous 3 years. So that knife cuts both ways, but trust me.
Mr. Fairchild, do you have a new structure on a piece of your property, one of your properties, where there was an old house, and it's in the blockhouse?
I tore it down.
Yeah, I'm down one structure.
You didn't replace anything there?
No.
Okay.
I'll let you know.
And he fixed it up.
I look at GIS aerials when I'm doing reviews. I knew the old one had been different. Yeah.
Y'all thought those were just drums. No,
it was a little
riding around it.
Yeah.
go back and refigure it.
All right. I do have one last question, I promise, because we were real close to getting the answer to this.
I had a feeling that was coming.
Mr. Flynn might be interested in this, but again, going back to that example of, you know, this is back to commercial. I got, you know, four units here, four units here, four units here. If the land is all $100,000 an acre, if that's the right number, you can correct me if I'm wrong. You know, they're all 2-acre lots, so we got, you know, $200,000 in acreage. Fine, understand that. Are you, as the assessor, making a determination that this particular shopping block here, all the same size, any different from the one that's located over here versus the one that's located over here? For example, are you saying, I have Lake Monticello, 20,000 square feet of commercial, I have Fork Union, 20,000 square feet of commercial, and I have Zion's Crossroads, 20,000 square feet of commercial. Is it just being measured on the actual square footage of commercial?
It's based on the classification of the construction, so also.
A, B, and C construction.
The age, okay. The classification, occupancy.
Okay.
Condition, Fork Union.
You're not collecting like the gross rent, though, are you?
No.
As part of your assessment.
We could send out requests for those, but we would very seldom get any return.
They have routinely factored in the geographics of it. You know, an acre of B1 at Zion's Crossroads is going to be higher than an acre of B1 at Lake Monticello, which is also higher than an acre of B1 in the Fork Union community. Factors out that away.
So you have that factor in as well too. Does the county collect gross rents from businesses? I know that Omaha does that. So
no, sir. Uh-uh.
That's like Fork Union. There's very little demand for commercial property.
For now,
that's going to change.
I hope it does. Because I think it's a nice old historic community.
Things change. I can guarantee you. When I sat in this room for study hall, and that's been probably 15, 20 years, or 40,
50.
That property in Fork Union would have been assessed at a higher value per acre than it was at Zion Crossroads.
Don't doubt that.
The dynamics change, and you know, as the dynamics may change for these communities, they'll look at that. But for commercial property, we effectively have the lake is the highest. The lake.
Basically,
and then Palmyra and Fort Canyon are third on that. So that's just the way it plays out at this point. But that dynamic might change as our county.
In the future.
Our area, the housing went up.
In the future, deal. Brick and mortar, commercial buildings, I don't know where they're headed.
Right.
By the way, we did build a 12x12 building. I just thought about that.
Make sure you get that on there.
Yeah, I want to make sure that's the brightest much as any other.
120 by 120, I got it.
Right, I thought that house was there already.
That was
it's a shed. It's an upload building.
That was a Class A building, I believe he said.
Oh, I think sure it is.
Party black with slate roof. Is that
that's a sauna.
You're close.
Yeah. Other questions?
All right. Thank you all so much. Any other questions? Because we are currently averaging about 30 minutes per presentation.
And I was going to mention too, after the first of the year when your Board of Equalization gets in session, if they have any questions, I'm always available. And Caitlin has my number.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for all the work you've done. We do appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Always a pleasure to see y'all.
Next up is H, Zion's Crossroads West Waterline Funding Update. Mr. Dahl,
I'm going to try and make it less than 30 minutes, definitely. So again, I don't want to go too much into this. Again, you know, if you remember back in February 2020, DEQ approached the county about sending the Zion's Crossroads Waterline 1.1 miles west, where it currently terminates at Memory Lane. So the reason they're doing that, they found out that we're building a water line on 250. Well, they've got probably about a half dozen properties down near the old Beaver Dam Market that have contaminated wells from previous petroleum release, and they've been doing it for 20 years. So DEQ approached the county and said, well, you know, we'll give you $200,000 for engineering, $800,000 for construction,
At the time, it was supposed to be a $1.5 million project. And so the county, when they took out some additional proceeds to finish the Zion's Crossroads project, we took out the $500,000 to finish the project. So this is kind of just showing where the water line is projected to go from Memory Lane here down to around just past the Beaver Dam Market. And again, here's just another picture of it. So again, if you remember, I came back to the board back in January of, you know, telling you at the time that costs were increased. So at this time, we knew costs were about $2.3 million above the $1.5, which was an $850 increase. So the board said, you know, go ahead and submit a grant application to VDH for the difference. So when we submitted the grant application, we got some updates on the construction figures, and they were about another $600,000 higher at that point. So that $1.5 million project is now about double the cost it was 2 years ago. Now, granted, there's about a 10% contingency built into those construction costs. And so again, at this point, you know, DEQ provided funding for design. So the design for the system and the project has been done, but moving forward, it hasn't. So those items in red is what has been expended to this point, and the other items are just kind of estimates that are there. So we submitted for the grant, and we just found out, and we submitted for $1.5 million, and we just found out October 18th that VDH was declining to award an offer for that. You know, I thought we had a really strong project, and our VDH rep did too. The problem is they had submissions for $880 million worth of applications for this, and they only could fund $130 million.
But know where they funded.
So what they said, they funded a lot of projects that were existing, that had existing issues, or lead pipes or asbestos pipes, things like that. And so those projects took priority first. So basically where we are, we're again still about $1.5 million short. And so, you know, kind of coming to the board, we really have three options at this point. You know, just kind of reapply again, and you know, we have a April deadline, and then we would find out what happens about a year from now if we get grant funding. The board could choose to move forward with unassigned fund balance, or the board could just say we don't want to pursue the project any further.
Did we pursue the monies that are available as part of the
infrastructure?
Well, it was the bipartisan infrastructure.
That is the same one.
It is. That's
because I know that there was just a ton of money.
Yeah, that's what we applied for. There was $880 million of applications, 130 versus fund, $130 million of funding. And again, the JRWA submitted for their project too, and they didn't get funding.
And how many families are affected?
So currently, there's six families there right now that are affected. I mean, so, you know, again, if you're looking at it from a cost standpoint versus what's being affected, I mean, DEQ, it's DEQ's responsibility right now to take care of it. They certainly have an incentive to not have to take care of it any longer. That's why for the Petroleum Release Fund, they've got up to $1 million in the Petroleum Release Fund that they can apply towards a project. So they've applied, they basically allocated and earmarked that $1 million. Mm-hmm. And so the $200,000 that we actually have an agreement with them on for the engineering work, there's no payback for the county for that if the board said we don't want to move forward. But again, at some point, the county was always intending to move forward. So
they never signed anything. We don't have any legal action.
Well,
no.
The only thing that I would say is that when we started the Zion's Crossroads Pipeline, the first estimate was, I think, we were going to pay $3 million. Or not, this was, I guess, our portion of the JRWA, not even the Zion's Crossroads. We were going to pay $3 million, Louisa was going to pay $3 million. Then, you know, year passes and it became, well, it's not going to be $6 million, it's going to be closer to $10 or $11 million.
Keep going.
And then, well, we know stuff happened and now we had to move it. And so now it's, you know, probably what, in the neighborhood of $25 million?
Yep.
And that's, again, for roughly 1.5 miles of pipeline, is that correct?
It's longer now, I mean, because at the point of fork, it was
But originally, right, it's longer, but
it's
going
to be less than a mile and a half.
Right.
And a little over a mile.
Yeah.
What's that?
It was just a smidge over a mile.
Now?
No, the original.
Oh, yeah.
It was a smidge over a mile, but because of the change of location. Yeah. And granted, we don't necessarily foresee a change of location here, but the point that I'm trying to make is that every year we delay, you can just count on the fact that it's just going to cost more money. And so if we decide to shelve this, which I'm not saying isn't a bad idea, fine, but no surprise if we come back 5 years from now and it's, instead of $3 million, it's $6 million. You know, it just seems to be that's the way it's going, right? So, you know, that's...
I just say it's an unintended consequence of not having the water line working all 2 years ago.
Not two.
If the water line's working 2 years ago, we get the thing put in the ground and it's $1.5 million and we're done and out the door. But that 2 years is now, if we do it, is a $1.5 million additional cost. So.
But I'll also say, argument could be made, why not build it three times as long then? Because 5 years from now, the next segments of it will be that much more expensive. So it's establishing a need, or is it just it'll be cheaper? And as y'all pointed out, the, what did you say, six households that are under the DEQ situation?
Yeah.
The way I understand it is there is no need, correct? Because DEQ will always make them whole.
Yes, DEQ will make them whole. The only difference is if, again, there's funding from DEQ to move it forward, and if we choose to say, well we want to give, you know, just back away, which we could, then the funding goes away from it. That's the only difference to it.
That's when we decided to do it, was we've always been in the plans to point to the county line, at least, or, you know, at least a meat chunk. And this was $1 million we wouldn't have to spend. That it saves us.
We don't have that much water right now.
No, ma'am, but hopefully that one's an argument that we could have and go for a long time, but hopefully we've got good will among everyone right now moving forward where we are. I guess is the best way I can put it. It doesn't seem like there's a giant hurdle in our way. Whereas the other one, it was a hurdle from the very beginning that we said we could overcome, and we didn't jump quite as high as we needed to jump, I guess. I don't know.
Are you referring to the water coming up 15?
No,
no, I'm talking about
JRWA. Once JRWA goes through, we'll have a lot of water at Sines Crossroads.
We would probably already have water from the JRWA here had it not been for...
The location.
And the location.
Seven years ago.
I know. Remember when you came onto the board 6 years ago, basically. Yeah. You know, they were saying it was going to be 2 years at that point in time. And here we are.
When we came on, it was going to be 2 years.
The JRWA took out bond proceeds in 2017.
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, I mean, like I said, there's no formal action, but I guess I just need some indication how the board wants to go, because if the board wants to go one way, then there may be formal action that needs to come back. And so those are really the three options.
Do you want to do it? Do you want to wait? Or do you just want to say, we're not going to do it? And like I said, we lose $1 million if we don't.
While we're also, you know, we can't go back. We are now the amount more than we were even when this first came up. And, we've made a big investment with taxpayer dollars. I don't see the need at this point to invest more.
I think we ought to move forward.
Ms. Eager?
I tend to agree with Mr. Fairchild. The money that we've already spent, do we have to make that up and give that back?
We don't.
Okay.
That was the one thing that we made sure of when we started this with them, that look, if we move forward with engineering funds, we want to make sure that we've got an out, that we're not
held responsible, because that was a concern. If we do the design and then we get to a point that it's going to cost more, well, you know, the consequences of COVID and just the economy, it just happened. So there is not a chance. But then at the same time, if the board said we wanted to hold off and wait for another funding round, you know, I'm not necessarily sure they're going to pull the money back if they know we're doing that. But I think if they know that we're just saying we're not moving forward with the project, period, then yeah, then they're probably going to pull the funds back.
Well, there's no harm in reapplying, is there?
No, there is definitely. I mean, even if the board said let's move forward with some degree, I would still recommend to move forward with the grant piece again, because. Well, I would have to think about the timing of things a little bit, because there is still a little work that needs to be done before you can even put out a bid. Not a lot, but so there is some timing. So I'd have to think about that a little bit if the board said, "Well, yeah, we do want to fund it, but you know, we still want to submit for an application."
Before we even found out, it'd be another year.
It would be another year.
You could reasonably, just based on the cost of construction estimates, tack on another 10-15% on the number that we've already got there, I would think, but I could be wrong about that. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this addition essentially added another one-third to the extension of the line that we have running down 250, is that right?
Yeah, so we did about a, Popowitz, Bobby.
It's 3 miles.
It's 4 miles, 3 miles of the Zions Crossroads line.
Five.
I don't think it's five. I was.
You got to remember, 15 goes down that way about another mile.
Yeah.
I'm just talking on 250, not.
About 3.5-4 miles.
From the jail to Zions Crossroads.
Well, I don't think it's that much, but again, it's probably another third of the project.
The new section is about 1.1 miles.
Yeah, well, that's what the new section is. Right. This section is about 1.1 miles.
This and the existing section is 3 miles, is what you're saying?
It's probably around 3.
25 to 30%, yes. Whatever, I guess, is what we're adding in terms of extension. So then the second question on that would be, when we look at potential lots that might be served by that 1.5 mile extension, mm-hmm. What do they really look like?
I would vote for number two. I thought I read something that there could be some contamination that would go beyond those six houses.
So technically there's four houses, but DEQ has also identified two houses that are right there that are basically on the
right. Yes. And whether there's any other areas.
I mean, those people have to be served, yeah, and they're going to be served whether we do the water line or not. Mm-hmm. But the question is, if we can get 1.1 miles of water line for $1.5 million,
yeah,
rather than $3 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I know I'm going 1.5 when it says 1.9, mm-hmm. But I also know we have $300,000 in contingency built into it. So,
but. September of 23, the way the trend is going, just since this was initiated, by September of 23, how much more is our piece going to be, which means more tax dollars. This thing is, so far, it's only getting more expensive. So if we were to apply and get the grant, wouldn't we just, isn't the likelihood that we would be on, that the taxpayers would be on the hook for even more than they are today?
You're saying if the board said let's move forward today, yeah, I think it's conceivable. I mean, again, going back to the estimate, again, this was an estimate from April, and I talked to our engineers about this estimate, and he said that estimate from April is similar, if not it may be a little bit higher than it was. He said some of the piping price have slowed down a little bit, because the pipe was the biggest. That's what saw a huge increase over that 2 year period of time. He's like, it's starting to subside a little bit, but he's like, you know, yeah, it's not going down, that's for sure.
Yeah. And DEQ's portion isn't going up, correct?
Correct. And I went back to DEQ too. I said, the board may be interested to move forward. I said, you know, with the cost increases, I said, do you have any additional funding you would want to put into this? And they just said they don't. I mean, a lot of the federal money is being plowed through the buy infrastructure law funding, and through the, which is administered through VDA.
They're giving us how much total? The DQ's total?
A million.
So, yeah. So, I mean, we don't do it, then this project three, and granted, some of it may be paid by, well, no, actually, to this point, I think this was brought up the last time when we were talking about it, is if you have, Mr. Popowitz, I think you were saying this, if you have somebody who wants the line, we build the line at our cost, but then am I not correct? Like, you wouldn't get the builder to build that main pipeline down 15 at that point.
I mean, it's possible. You could.
Is it common, or?
I guess it depends on.
Well, it's not common. It's a main built like that. Right. Yeah, yes, it's done.
It's done. I mean, it's possible, but it's.
You talked about the public hearing the other day, right?
What's that?
The public hearing. That was a public hearing. You brought me up to speed on that. They may extend it down 15.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, they potentially could.
Yeah, because that if you look just at the graphic there, you know, there's if I recall that whole piece to the north of Beaver Dam there, that's a very substantial piece of property back there.
400 something.
Yeah. And so that's very potentially attractive if you're looking at an industrial park or, you know, some sort of park from that standpoint. That's about as big of a park as we're going to have in that area.
And plus the fact that you would still be using for grant money.
Well, of course, one of the problems with that, this has come up with one possible development, and that is somebody comes in with a very large project and he says, we've got, you know, $2 million to spend on getting the water to our place. Problem is his demand's so high that we can't supply.
Yeah.
Or caps out the
system. Today, right. We this is still, by the time this is built, it's a year away, and by the time JRW water shows up, it's a year away. You know, you're sort of feeding the pipeline, so to speak.
Yeah, so it's unlikely that we'd get an application like that would approve.
Right.
But it's almost possible.
I look at it and I think, long-term, we're saving $1 million for sure, because we're not going to get that money from, well, you might get it from a developer. And opportunity-wise, if we do this now, when we get the water from the JRWA, that's very well positioned, you know, piece of property. You don't see that type of acreage around infrastructure, you know, on a major highway like that. That's pretty uncommon. So I think if we're looking at site plans, you know, that to me, it makes sense to go forward.
All righty, so. You still don't think it's a good idea, Ms. Egan?
No, I think it's probably a good thing to have happen, because we're going to need water extending. We're going to grow.
We're going to grow. Mm-hmm. And in my thought process, we got $1 million in our pocket that's not coming out of our taxpayers' pocket.
Mm-hmm. How much was it? Originally, was there an estimate originally?
Yeah,
1.5.
Okay, and so at this point, we've surpassed, the county's not on this, even with the 1 million. We've surpassed the 1.5 that was originally.
We were only going to put up a $500,000.
Yeah.
We were getting a mile of line for $500,000.
The total project was going to be $1.5 million. DEQ was putting in $1 million. The county was going to put in $500,000.
I asked it wrong, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I should have clarified. Was this something the board looked at, this piece, before the DEQ part?
Yes. There's future phases in the Zion's Crossroads master plan.
So was phase two ever priced back then? Was there a cost associated with this back?
I'm sure it was. I know that there was, and we chose to go with the from the prison back.
I think the original DXR, project was $8 million. When
Something
we
like
first
that.
Started calculating this, was $8 million. I remember Mr. Smith telling me you can basically book about $2 or $3 million per mile. So he thought our estimate was a little bit low. I think we're $12 million?
Well, I think what Mr. Popowitz is talking about is that you now count going down to memory lane and all the way down to the back end of memory lane.
Right.
So that's probably a mile right there. Mm-hmm. So that's where, that's why going from a prison to Zion's Grocery is probably only about 2.7, 3 miles, something like that. But then you add in the other extension, yeah, and down 15, then you're looking at 4.5 to 5 miles.
Yeah, so I mean, to Mr. Sheridan's point, we're at $12 million, granted that included a lot of, you know, other things such as the elevation storage, yeah, and all those kinds of things. But if you take all of that and so separate, let's say we've got 3 miles, and let's say it cost us
at least three million per mile.
Two and a half to three million dollars per mile,
and we can do this one for 1.9.
Right. Let me just bring one thing to the board's attention too. I mean, so one thing that the board is going to want to consider too for Zion's Crossroads in totality. I mean, so one, we got the water line. So from a sewer line where everyone is, you just don't hook people up necessarily to the force main. You create regional pump stations. So from the Zion's Crossroads line, you know, from a staff standpoint, for the whole Zion's Crossroads, when you're looking at from the glass property, 250-15, better living area, Starlight Business Park going mm-hmm. south, there's going to need to be some type of sewer infrastructure upgrades up there to really be able to handle that growth area there. So I don't want the board to just kind of look at this piece without letting them know that there could be some potential sewer upgrades that need to happen in that corridor too. So I just want to make sure that you're aware of both of those things before you make a decision on this, because from a sewer piece too, looking at, you know, some of the components that may be needed there, as that is an area probably more primed for growth sooner than later, is, you know, a project up there to expand, you know, another kind of like regional pump station and some gravity feeds, that could potentially be $3 to $4 million. So before the board says, yeah, let's go with this, and then, you know, something potential comes back, again, I think we would need to do some preliminary engineering to see what that looks like up there, but I just want the board to be aware of that component too before you commit to this, with knowing that, you know, that there may be something like that at Zion still.
You're talking about like maybe an addition to the prison system?
No, this is not an addition to the prison system. This is just expanding. This is expanding the sewer lines.
Like what's in front of Max.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
In the planning commission, there's, you know, proposals for two properties that are running down 250 right now.
Yeah. Now some of those, they're not necessarily. They wouldn't build like a regional pump station or gravity mains. They may build lines going to their thing, but there's a lot of extra other components that go with that. So I just want the board to be aware that there may be some other things of that are critical from an economic development point of Zion's.
We've known sewer is going to be the next big expense. I mean, that's a given, right? I mean, we know that sewer is, you know, we have a limited sewer to begin with. That's going to be a big expense coming down the road.
And I should just mention the reason in my question of if you all considered this originally, this piece, I'm just rounding numbers. If, let's say if it was $2 million then, that would have cost extra. And if it was $2 million now, it'd be an obvious question. Well, why would you not spend the $2 million then, but you'll spend the $2 million now?
Yeah, but it's $3.5 million versus $2 million, right? Because that's what the cost is, right? You know, the fact that DEQ is allowing us to spend $2.5 million, but the real cost is $3.5 million. So
yeah. And again, it'd be more likely a year from now.
It'd be more likely to be even. I mean, who knows? Maybe the cost of pipes went up, you know, triple. I don't know the answer to that, but it, you know,
and again, you know, so here's the thing. So let's just say this. Let's just say the board says we want to move forward with this. I mean, certainly at this point, there may be some more design stuff, some finishing design stuff that needs to be done. But I mean, but frankly, if you go out for bid, there's some cost to getting all the design documents and the bid documents together. So you go out to bid, say you go out to bid and it comes back at, it's called $4 million. Say this, what we're saying is a $3 million project is a $4 million project. Well, you may have spent some things on some additional engineering to get it up to a certain point. You won't necessarily, I mean, if bids come in and it's $4 million, it's more than that the board wanted to move forward with. You don't have to move forward with it. That's, and so again.
Or it could come in lesser because the price of the pipe.
It's potential, yeah. I mean, that's a potential. So if the board says we want to move forward with the unassigned fund balance, it doesn't mean it's going to be all spent until we know what a bid would really come back at. But again, the board needs to know that there would be some additional cost to get it up to that point to go.
I mean, that $50,000 or something of that nature.
For I mean, and some of that too. You know, again, we still, if you go back here, you know, we're at about 175 out of the 200,000 that DEQ is allowing towards the engineering piece. So just.
Well, and if you just look at the construction administration and inspection component, that in itself has doubled in less than 2 years, right? Mm-hmm. So if we spend that today, probably money well spent. Because that, I would think a lot of that information is still relevant.
Yeah, the only thing out of this, I mean, the only really thing that would be spent out of this, out of whatever the 125 is, just the bidding piece. There would be some work from the engineers to get bid documents together, but construction admin and construction inspection, that only goes on if you've got a project that's actually approved and moving forward. So
where are we?
Let's move forward.
All right. So we can move forward with getting the engineering, the final, all that stuff done, and that's still on DEQ's ticket.
I don't think we're and if there's anything that
falls. If we decide later if it comes back and it's too much, then we don't have to do it. But going back to your thing, Chris, we didn't want to, with what we had with JRWA and what we had with Zion Crossroads, the park that we were building, because it was useless to do JRWA if we didn't have pipes in the ground. But this was definitely something that we talked about going ahead and getting done. Not something that we just said, oh, that's useless, that's pipe dreams 20 years from now. It wasn't 20 years from now. It was when the water gets there, we want to have the ability to expand this line so we can grow our tax base, like we always talk about.
It was a little bit of that, and the other side of it was, well, you'll never need all the water from the JRWA, right? So it was a sort of chicken egg thing, you know. You need the pipes in the ground if you're going to get the water from the JRWA, so you need to move forward with this quote ZXR. And when we were looking at it, well, you still had to build the tower. You still had to build, you know, some of the piping going up and down. You still had to spend all the engineering. And so really when you looked at getting the water from DEQ out of that quote-unquote $12 million that we ended up spending, really maybe $3 or $4 million was the water from the DEQ. All the rest was what we would have needed to spend.
Department of Corrections.
Right. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry, it's DEQ, DOC. Yeah. Corrected there. So,
all right. Yeah. So let's go ahead.
So I'll bring something formal back to the board at the next meeting for that. And again, I'll talk to our engineers and again just try and track the remaining engineering dollars to see what's needed to get it up to invitation for bid standpoint. And then I'll bring that back
just
to the board.
Yeah, just keep us in the loop on it as you go.
Yep.
Next, we'll move on with the consent agenda. I, minutes of October 19th, 2022, Ms. Solis. J, temporary staff stipend for additional duties, Gatewood, Ms. Snow. And K, phone system maintenance for E911, agreement to correct amendment to end-user agreement with CenturyLink Communications, LLC, Ms. Allen. Is there anything y'all want to pull? Do I have a motion to accept the consent agenda?
So moved.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Booker. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Is there any unfinished business?
Yeah, we didn't mention that they had senior day. Your report, I thought you were going to put senior day. We had senior day on the 26th, very well attended. They had breakout sessions where they taught the elderly, such as myself. They had a cane They taught them how they could defend themselves. They actually got up and did the activity with the cane. I mean, a lot of them showed them how to balance themselves. They had one on scams. They did a hearing test. They gave the shots, whatever you needed, shingles or a booster, whatever. So it was, and Captain Von Hill and his six or seven volunteers pulled all of this together. They had a lunch, delicious lunch for the elderly. They served them. They had the Academy young men came down. Catherine
Garcia
brought her young men down, and they helped the elderly and went around and passed out there. We had vendors galore, is that a good word? They had all kinds of good things that people could pick up. The tables were loaded with pens, with lotions, with hand things, and bags to put it in. And it was a really good feeling of a fellowship. I got there a little bit late, and I said I was going to leave early. I didn't leave until 2:30. It was over at 2 because of seeing people I hadn't seen, looking, and of course, they're my peers. They're y'all's peers, too. Not some of y'all. Maybe not you.
Thank you.
The rest of us are all over 55. Yes, ma'am.
But I did want to bring that
That's
out.
That's why you live in a little shed.
Because that we haven't had one in such a long time. And so
that sounds wonderful.
Okay, next time, y'all elderly people need to come.
Yes, ma'am. I've taken off work, but I've been there. Speaking of that, and I don't know if y'all mentioned this or not, but the postcard I got from Puma.
Yeah.
On behalf of our normal Colonel Goetjes.
Colonel Coggins.
Coggins. That's right, it's an N.
Yep.
Puma invites you to attend the Veterans Day ceremony. I'm not going to be able to attend it on November the 11th. Ms. Booker, I know you will.
Yeah.
But it's at 11 a.m. They're going to have a lunch in the dining hall. And I know one of my former teammates, one of Chris's former teammates, is over there making sure they got good food in the down hall with William Franklin.
And we're really talking about really trying to get veterans to come out because they do this every year.
You should see them kids when I tell those kids, I say, yeah, you know who the fastest person I ever seen in the 800 meters is? I'll point over there at William. William's like myself. We're not quite as slender as we used to be.
I was going to say, he's eating a little bit of his overcooking.
Yeah, sir. I tell you what, it happens to the best of us.
Yeah, and the other thing is, unfortunately, we can't have some of our kids to come over because the cadets, have you ever seen them on that day? The cadets lined up properly with their dress uniforms on. It is very impressive. So, but we need to, I've been trying to encourage some veterans around in the Falk Union area, but it's had a bad time.
Yep.
You know.
Yes, ma'am. Middle of the day on a Friday.
It's not a good time. But.
Alrighty. Any new business?
Well, sort of along the same line. It occurs to me our next meeting is on December 7th.
I already thought about that. Yeah. We're talking about having something.
Well, we had Len Gardner, who passed, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I think it wasn't last year, but the year before.
Yes.
Who spoke to us, and it was Chris. I don't think you were here, but he was literally recounting when he was a boy, and had gone to a Veterans Day meeting. This was on December 7th. This was for Veterans Day, and there were veterans from the Civil War speaking, which was really pretty impressive to hear. But it occurs to me that if we have any veterans that served. In Pearl Harbor, I think we have one or two in the area that might be appropriate for us to track them down and recognize them on December 7th, or at least recognize their names.
How was one month?
The closest one I know is Jack Hughes' son.
Jack Hughes' son.
Colonel?
Yeah.
Colonel
was in Vietnam for a long time. All right, Eric, new business? All right, hearing none, Mr. I will now open the second round of public comments. Anyone wishing to address the board, please keep your comments 5 minutes on topic and directed to the board. Also, please state your name and address. Is there anyone wishing to speak at this time? And I look down there and I see all employees of the county. So, except for Ms. Best.
No, I don't see anyone.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the Ferrara County Board of Supervisors.
Hang on. I got to close it.
Oh, sorry.
I'll close the first, second round of public comments, seeing no one wishes to speak. All right, Mr. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, I move the Ferrara County Board of Supervisors to enter into the closing provisions of Section 2.2-3711A1, Section 2.2-3711A5, Section 2.2-3711A6, Section 2.2-3711A19 of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended for the purposes of discussing personnel, county attorney services, respective industry, respective business updates, investment of funds, Louisa County Water Agreement, public safety, structure of emergency services, threat assessment evaluation plan.
Second.
Motion's been made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mrs. Booker. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. We're now in closed session.
That's
Mr. Chair, I move the closed meeting be adjourned and the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be resolved. The Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge. One, only public business matters lawfully exempt from open meeting requirements in Section 2.2-3711A1 of the Code of Virginia 1950, as amended. And two, only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting.
Second.
That's enough.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Booker. Mr. Fairchild.
Aye.
Ms. Eager.
Aye.
Ms. Booker.
Aye.
Mr. O'Brien. Chair votes aye. We are now out of closed session. Do I have a motion to extend until 9:30?
I move we extend to 9:30.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All right, got a motion made by Ms. Booker, seconded by Mrs. Eager. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion
opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
So made.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Chair votes aye. We are adjourned.
We had 3 minutes.